welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. You look at the race down in down in there in South Carolina, the Sanford Colbert Bush race tightening up. So what's the GOP do? Well, what Republicans always do, attack the workers, go after them. They won't know we're talking about them. Nice job there. Also, the attack on workers continues as the GOP works diligently to destroy what few labor laws we have left in this country that protects workers. We'll talk about that. Also, more fun with guns, and it's Earth Day. It is Earth Day, the communist plot that it is. I got to see all of the right-wing arguments that, you know, Earth Day is, it's just like Lenin's birthday, and it's Communist Day, and, oh, but they won't tell you about that. How dare they want air and water and trees? How much more proof do you need that the commies are taking over when they want air and water and trees, especially the trees? That's what they're saying. I mean, it just blows my mind. The level of insanity that has gripped the right wing of this country. And what's amazing to me is they keep going further and further and further because they've got to out-crazy the crazy just to get attention at this point. Because insane just isn't enough. You've got to be freaking insane to get any attention. So we're going to talk about that. Also, take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take your thoughts on the weekend, you know, the big chase over the weekend, all of the latest tragedies, whatever's on your mind. I don't know about you, but I opened the paper on Sunday. And, you know, it was one of those things that, you know, I like to sit down and I like to actually read the newspaper on Sunday. Cause I got a little time to spend with the family. My kids take the cartoons and my wife goes to the sales stuff and I read the opinion pages and the news stuff. And, you know, it's like a whole day thing. It's kind of like a family ritual almost. So I open up the opinion page and the gun issue is front and center. So the big, big question about, oh, it's the guns. And I read John Misek's piece, who I generally like. So the headline of the article is Senate Gun Control Vote, a Profile in Cowardice. And so just the first paragraph, cowards, he writes. There's no other way to describe the six members of the majority Democrat United States Senate who stood in the way of new gun control laws that are so simple and so reasonable that only a fool or a knave would oppose them. And at first, you know, I sat there and I read it and I go, well, you know, why are you only picking on the six ignorant Democrats? Because there were 40 ignorant Republicans. Why not go after them? And then it dawned on me, duh. They are fools. They are the knave. It is what they are. They will stand in the way of any reasonable progress. They will stand in the way of any reasonable thought because they're bought and paid for. And look, you got the handful of Democrats. Harry Reid voted against it solely so that he could reintroduce it. So to say that there were six was a little disingenuous. It was really the other ones. It was, you know, the same ones that have been causing all of the problems in the Democratic Party because they're really Republicans. But this gun thing has me kind of, you know, thinking, you know, there's something awry here. And, you know, when Pat Toomey was one of the guys to come out and say, oh, okay, we're going to come out with something, you go, maybe he's got aspirations of being above and beyond just a senator. Maybe he wants to be vice president or something down the road. And this was an opportunity to get Democrats to sing his praises. So there in the opinion page, I see Kathleen Kane, the attorney general, the newly elected attorney general, the Democrat, saying, oh, we need more leaders like Senator Toomey. Yes, we need more people. So reinforce that, you know, this guy did one thing well. When you look at all of the other things that he's done that I would argue are just – just so destructive to the working people of this state and of this country. And then you've got Stephen Reed, the former mayor of Harrisburg, which I got to be honest, I didn't think the Patriot News would even allow him to subscribe, let alone put an article in their paper, considering what's going on here in the city of Harrisburg because of him and the policies that he brought about. But his byline, well, Toomey brought a level of civility, a civility to the gun divide. He was civil about it. And, you know, I look at this, and the story's over and over. It's just this big Toomey love fest. And I want to be the one to say, wait a minute. Toomey's the guy who sent out a fundraising letter for the really radical right-wing Tea Party Commonwealth Foundation. Sent out a letter begging them to give more money to this radical Tea Party group to push more of their free market ideology that has failed this country so miserably. More deregulation, more screw the workers, more union busting. Oh, well, you know, we need to get more people like the Tea Party think tank to push their propaganda. You've got a U.S. senator out there pimping for this group. There is something seriously wrong with this. And my favorite part, and I got to be honest, my favorite part of the whole thing, as I'm reading through the letter that Toomey sent out, to all of the Tea Party think tanks supporters. The last line is, we need the Commonwealth Foundation, the Tea Party think tank, so for freedom. And I'm going, what in the name of Sam Hill does that even mean? And what it means is it's just more. We're going to bring in as much money as we can possibly bring in so that we can continue to screw the workers. He goes, please join me in support of the Commonwealth Foundation today, because together we can transform Pennsylvania for freedom. Let me ask you this. Are you uncomfortable with a U.S. senator out there pimping to give an extreme group like the Commonwealth Foundation a platform to raise money off of his seat? See, I have a serious problem with that. I have a serious problem with him cozying up to a really radical right-wing extremist group who, in my view, has never done anything to help a working person in this state. It's infuriating on so many levels. And I look at this, and, you know, for me, this should be completely outlawed. This idea that you have got a sitting U.S. senator out there pimping for money for this group. Do you not have a problem with that? Because I do. I seriously do. And this anti-worker agenda, I really, really have a problem with. You know, this is a group who's gone after prevailing wage. This is a group who's gone wanting to make Pennsylvania a right-to-work state, to take what few rights workers have away from them. And to go after and destroy collective bargaining. Pennsylvania State Senator John Eichelberger, a Republican, is now putting around a co-sponsorship memo. One of those things that just, you kind of go, well, you know, the extremists, the crazies, they're out there pimping their stuff. They're out there, you know, doing what the Commonwealth Foundation is telling them to do. Out there doing what ALEC is telling them to do. Anyway, Eichelberger sends out a co-sponsorship memo last week, oddly enough, on tax day. Asking people to help co-sponsor his Promoting Fairness and Taxpayer Protection in Collective Bargaining Act. Bottom line is, this state senator wants to go after and screw firefighters and cops and the such out of collective bargaining rights. He says that I will be introducing legislation to reform the Policemen and Firefighter Collective Bargaining Act, commonly known as Act 111. Because he wants to provide fairness and transparency. Am I the only one who watched television this weekend or turned on the news and thought, wow, those people who are chasing this guy who's shooting at them and throwing bombs at them, that takes some level of courage. Am I the only one who saw the towers come down and saw people running towards them wearing firefighter outfits and police uniforms and thought, wow, those are people who are courageous and who are dedicated to their job and to community service? I look at someone like Mr. Eichelberger, who says to them, yes, we want you to do that. We want you to chase down the bad guy. We want you to run into burning buildings and save people and kittens. But we don't want to pay you. We don't want you to be able to support your family. We want you to be desperate like the rest of the workforce. And for me, instead of saying, hey, how do we make sure everyone has collective bargaining rights so that we can all eat and we can all survive? You've got Republicans in this state who are saying, you know what, those firefighters and those cops, they don't need that. We need to take those rights away from them and do to them what employers across this country have done to their workforce, which is impose their will. And, you know, over the weekend I was thinking about this, because I was thinking about the Tea Party think tanks, their project, which they're going after the organized labor. And all they have to do is they've picked out an enemy, and we're going to destroy them, we're going to go after them. And the unions are going, wait a minute, we just want to represent our members. We want our members to have a voice. All of us are in this together. They don't want to destroy business. They don't want to destroy the taxpayer. They want to represent their people. And there's a really very unbalanced playing field, because you've got this Tea Party think tank who's hell-bent on destruction. We're going to destroy you. We're going to beat you into the ground. We're going to humiliate you. We're going to do all these things. Where on the other side, you've got these folks who are saying, you know what, I just want to do my job. And I want to be able to support my family. And when I retire and there's something left, I want to be able to have a little dignity in my old age. You talk to the firefighters, you talk to the cops, you talk to any union worker. They don't want to destroy their company. They're proud of what they do. They have extraordinary amount of pride in what it is that they do. So they're not pointing, going, ah, we're going to destroy them. No, that's the Tea Party think tank saying, you know what, we're going to destroy you. And it's amazing to me that any working person in this state would consider listening to one of these people over at the Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. Yet you've got this right-wing radio station in this listening area who is basically their mouthpiece. Whatever comes out of the Tea Party think tank comes out of the mouths of the people who are on the air there, and they're always on there, and they're always pimping their stuff, and they've even got their listeners who regurgitate their... I heard a guy today saying, well, you know, if we could get those construction workers to work for less money, we'd be able to build more stuff if they made more less money. See, all we have to do is get rid of that prevailing wage, get rid of those wages, and get those workers to work for less money, because they'd work for less money if they didn't have a choice. And then we could save, and the guy threw it out there, we could save 30% on all building costs. And I'm going, wait a second, you're not going to save 30%. The cost of labor isn't even 30% of the building projects. How the hell are you going to save 30% when that's not even the cost of doing the project? Doesn't matter. Facts be damned. It's all in what the right-wing Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, keeps putting in their ear, keeps pounding at them. And you've got this station there in Harrisburg just regurgitating without even thinking. And look, I don't expect them to think. They're not that bright. They just regurgitate ad nauseum exactly what they're told, because they, like the Tea Party think tank, bought and paid for with money that Senator Toomey is out there pimping to get them. There is something seriously wrong. Something stinks in Denmark, and it starts with a U.S. senator. Something seriously wrong. I got to take a break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
April 16th was National Library Workers' Day, and AFSCME, which represents 25,000 library workers nationwide, held celebrations, including one on the steps of the downtown library in New Haven, Connecticut. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
AFSCME represents 40 workers in the New Haven system. Librarian Bill Armstrong mentioned some of the things the library can do for patrons.
We can help you find out how to bake a cake, fix your car, and play the guitar. In short, we help you do the things you want and need to do to improve and enrich your lives, and if we can't, we'll find someone for you who can.
The last comment may have been a reference to four Connecticut librarians' courageous refusal to honor the conditions of a national security letter sent out during the Bush administration, which demanded that librarians turn over information on patrons' library use as part of the war on terror and not reveal their actions to anyone on pain of prosecution. They were eventually vindicated and not prosecuted. Others spoke of all the cultural and educational programming that's available at the main location and at the city's four branch libraries. Things like reading hour for babies, English classes for immigrants, computer instruction, and help with job searches. 10-year-old Alejandro Lopez also spoke in praise of librarians. He said his mom has been bringing him to the library for years because his whole family loves to read.
In the Fairhaven Library, she can get her books in Spanish, and I get my fiction and nonfiction books and movies. The staff there is always friendly and helpful.
As budget cuts come and go, library hours have been cut back and workers laid off. Many residents say libraries should be the last thing to be cut, since they serve such a fundamental role in the life of a democracy, and since patrons tend toward those of lower income who have less access to computers. Melissa Canham Klein said she became a librarian because of the wonderful staff she met at her branch library. She began as a volunteer, then a part-time worker.
I started at the very lowest level of the library, and my brothers and sisters of Locals 3144 and 884, they took me from that lowest level on up. They believed in me. They taught me the skills I need. I went to library school to learn the rudiments of being a librarian, but I learned the practice of librarianship from these people here. Thank you.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
What keeps you up at night, Governor? What part of all of those worries concerns you the most? The cuts, the tax cuts?
Well, usually I wake up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I wonder where we are going to balance the budget. We have a pension crisis, just like every other state just about has a pension crisis.
Right, but you've had success. I want our viewers to know you've balanced two previous budgets, if not more. Right. Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've closed deficit holes of more than $4 billion. You've had success.
Success! Reminds me of the Three Stooges. Success! 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 Yes, he's had success. And you know how he's had success? Well, we kick people off of working poor off of insurance. We kick the neediest and the most vulnerable off the general assistance budget. We eviscerate public education. And, you know, that stuff. We do it off the backs of those who can least afford it. And the pension crisis that he talked about, let's just make it worse by not even making the contributions now that we're supposed to, much like the same thing that kind of got us into the mess we're in now. Yes, he's had success. Congratulations. With that kind of success, please, please, keep it to yourself. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So good news. You know how the Republicans love to talk about with that competition Evidently, there's been a new bid, contract to run the executive branch's websites, and State Treasurer Rob McCurd is saying, no, not going to pay it. We want answers. We want to know if it's legit. We want to know why it is you didn't put it out for bid, and a whole lot of other questions, and good for him. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on the State House with the insanity that I'm seeing, I've got Scott Conklin, our good friend, State Representative, to come talk to us. Scott, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So I see this co-sponsorship memo put out by John Eichelberger, a state senator. He is saying, and you know, this is just repulsive to me. He's asking his fellow senators to co-sponsor the Promoting Fairness and Taxpayer Protection in Collective Bargaining Act. What they want to do is they want to go back and quote-unquote reform the Policemen and Firemen Collective Bargaining Act, commonly known as Act 111, basically screwing the people that we're calling heroes out of their pensions, out of their wages, and out of the ability to have any say in what they do. And in light of what's gone on in Boston, do you think he could have had any better timing?
I don't think there's ever a good time for that, but in light of what's happening right now, it has to be some of the worst timing possible.
I compare that with the Brad Rowe thing from last year. We're going to do away with prevailing wage for the kids. You know, the kids who might be sick or their parents may have died in war. Because you know what? Because dead kids and dead parents, they're more important than those unions.
Well, you know, Rick, at the end of the day, the idea is that, you know, it's an open and free America and it's an open and free Pennsylvania. As long as you're with the Commonwealth Foundation, or perhaps the Manufacturers Association, or perhaps one of the groups that, you know, can barely make it on $1 billion a year. But other than that, we're not free anymore. We have to figure out ways to buy our legislators, to come up with ways to pass new legislation, because we live in 10-second sound bites. We no longer live in an area to where we can actually get into a deep policy discussion. We have to figure out what the 10-second soundbite is, and then we're able to manipulate the airways with it. It's not good for Pennsylvania, and it's not good for the workers at all.
No, not at all. And, you know, the thing is, you know, I listen to these other shows where people are just regurgitating what these Tea Party think tanks are putting out there without thinking, what's it going to do to the community? You're defunding education. What's that going to do to the future of our country? You're moving from public education to these charter schools that have no track record of doing any better, and in fact have actually done worse in a lot of cases. What's that for the future of our country? What are we doing to our kids?
Well, you know what I found interesting, and it shows I'm getting old. Back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, when you'd hear someone trying to be elected into office, they would talk about hiring school teachers. They would talk about putting police officers on the street. They would talk about making your neighborhood safe. Over the last 2 years, we have 20,000 less school teachers in Pennsylvania teaching our kids. Our state police force, there's only 4,300 troopers to start with. We may be down as many as 1,000 troopers by the end of this year. Effort to just close. They're talking about closing other state police barracks because we won't fund the cadet classes to put these young folks in. We have free health care for Pennsylvanians if we would accept it. New Jersey's Governor Christie accepted it. Other Republican governors have taken it. But our governor is run by such an ideological, and the legislators run by such an ideological, not mainstream, but their own little perception of reality. We actually have politicians today are running and getting elected when they say, I'm going to have less school teachers, I'm going to have less police officers, I'm going to make sure you don't get the health care that every other state's taking because we're going to keep it from you. We're not going to fix our highways. We're not going to invest anything, but we're going to give a $1 billion tax break to a foreign oil company to build a cracker plant that they're only building because the gas is here, or we're going to give a foreign country a contract on our lottery system, or we're going to privatize a liquor store, which, by the way, puts a $200 million hole in our budget, puts people on the streets, and alcohol prices go up. I've never seen anything like this in all my life.
I'm just, you know, when you put it into that way, it's exactly where we are. It's the It's probably one of the best summaries that I've heard, because it's exactly where we are. And it, if you listen to the, to what the media is putting out to folks, yeah, and it's, and I go back to, you know, it's all we see, it's all we hear, it's all we read, this ideological push towards privatization, deregulation, lower wages. I actually heard a guy, I was driving home from driving home this afternoon, I heard a guy say, I don't know why those construction workers aren't willing to just work for less money. It's, my whole head almost exploded.
Well, that's, you know, that's exactly right. I had an argument with one of my colleagues. Not an argument. We had a discussion during the liquor sales. And I said, do you understand we're putting a $200 million hole in the budget? And he said, I don't care. We need to be out of the liquor business. And I said, we're not going to be out of the liquor business. When you look at Washington State, which you keep bringing up, you're seeing more underage drinking, more DUI, more theft. More problems. Small businesses going out of business because they can't afford to compete with the large box stores. But what the conversation led to was is that we got into a discussion over bottom up and top down economics. He believes in top down economics. I said, I've been in business for over 30 years. I've been in the construction business, and now I'm still in the retail business, where we have a store. I said, you cannot sell anything if people don't have money.
Yep.
You can't sell a candle, you can't sell a car, you can't sell anything if people do not have expendable cash to spend. And what you want to do is taking expendable cash out of the hands of the masses, and you're not going to have anybody buying product. He didn't buy it, he told me. He said, no, top-down works. You give money to big corporations, they invest it.
In China.
That's why, well, they buy them. You're right. They take a trip. They invest in the stock market. And here's where we run into problem. I believe that large corporations should make money, 100%, because if they don't make money, people don't have jobs. And if people don't have jobs, they don't buy product. But you have to pay them a decent wage.
Right.
That's where I believe we draw the line, where you and I believe there's nothing wrong with a profit. I believe there's something wrong with a decent wage. And again, one of the problems we're having is that we have, within our union, people are listening, they still have a hard time understanding that we do the third rail issues to get them to vote what we want, guns, abortion, and those things. No one's taking your guns away. No one's, you know, no one's doing anything, but we lose them on those issues. What we have to do is do what Rick Smith's doing. Keep it out there, making them understand what the long-term picture is. One of the things I had a talk with the School Boards Association, and I said, do you all realize that they're working towards this governor and this legislative body are working towards privatization of all schools? And they said they do understand that. And I said, now, I've got a question for you. And this is a true conversation we had. I said, you understand that charter schools, private schools, cyber schools put more money into campaign contributions than PSEA did last year? And they said, yes, we absolutely understand that. I said, then why are you pushing for this furlough bill? I asked them, how did you get rid of 20,000 teachers last year if you can't furlough a teacher, if you can't get rid of one? I said, it's a bogus argument. But don't you understand the only way to save public schools is for the teachers to be able to have enough teachers who give those couple of pennies to put into a fund to fund people who are able to stand up to big corporations, the large charter schools, the unregulated schools. I said, and I'm not against charter schools, I'm not against public schools, but at the same time, when you take all the good kids out, you put them in the charter schools, you leave the disruptive kids in the school district, I said, it doesn't work. And the person in the School Boards Association agreed with me. They said they're absolutely correct, that they've got their backs to the wall, and the only people that are saving them is the union right now.
Yeah.
I never thought, Rick, I'd hear the day that a member of the school, someone who's an executive of the School Boards Association, I won't give their name because they're a good person, admits that the only thing that's saving the school district is PSEA right now. How's that for a turnaround of effects?
But that's always been the case, though, Scott. I mean, these are the people who are advocating not just for themselves, but for their kids and for the school and for the district, because if they don't, Who's going to? The school board association, they're funded by the state. I mean, they're just an arm of the governor's office, in my view.
And what's interesting, though, is that they're finally beginning to see that their schools are in jeopardy. They're going to, and it surprised me to see that they finally got it. They finally understand that the only people to save them is the union. As ironically as that sounds, and it was an interesting, in fact, you know, you were talking about prevailing wage. I was having a conversation with some of my labor folks this morning, and I was telling them, I said, you need to come up with a simple explanation to people about that 30%. And I heard you talking about it, and it's mathematically impossible to save 30% on the job. Mathematically impossible. Yep. In fact, when you look where they've gone out to bid, I can show you case after case where the low bid was a union, and they jumped over the low bid to a non-union company to give it to them.
Because it's all about ideology.
It's all about campaign contributions. Let's say it the way it is. It's an ideological view, but those who are in control have realized they can get millions of dollars in campaign contributions by doing the will of those individuals. And the surprising thing about it, if they'd ever get their way, they would destroy what they want to build up themselves. Again, it goes back to basic economics. You cannot sell a product if no one can buy it.
I remember having that conversation with a small businessman in my community who said, you know, there was a plant that had asked for a 50% pay cut. And he goes, well, those workers make too much money. They make too much money. They should take the pay cut. I go, well, fine, but that's your money that's being cut. Because that's the money that they used to spend in your store. And he didn't get that. And I doubt he ever did, but he's out of business now. So you know where his money went.
Well, it's always the question I always ask somebody when they say, someone in the union makes too much money. And I say, can you tell me exactly what a laborer makes in the union? Can you tell me exactly that someone that empties bedpans in a nursing home makes? Can you tell me exactly what school teachers start out in rural Pennsylvania? And the surprising answer is, because they're very knowledgeable that the unions are destroying it and they're overpaid, the answer will be every time, Rick, I don't know.
But I know it's less than what that guy makes. And that's the thing that amazes me, Scott. You know, I talk to so many people who they're good at pointing the finger and saying, well, they shouldn't have that. Instead of going, well, wait a second, how do I get that? I mean, the pension issue for me is a huge one, because I've talked to people who said, well, we can't really argue the pension in public because the majority of citizens in this state and this country have gotten screwed by the private sector, have lost their pensions, and they look at someone who has it and say, well, I got screwed out of mine. I don't have one. They shouldn't either. And to me, that's a fundamental flaw in the thinking of working people in this country.
You're absolutely correct. Act 120 a few years ago that all the Republicans voted for, almost all my colleagues voted for, actually fixed the pension system. And I heard you talking about it. Is that if we don't put in that contribution, we're only going to make it worse. And here's what I can't get people to understand. If we start another pension system, we make things worse. That you can't take people out of the present pension system, put new people in a new pension system. You only make the whole what Pennsylvania has to pay even higher. And incidentally, according to the actuaries, by 2018 to 2020, we've taken care of the pension system if we stay on track.
But isn't the point to do just that, to destroy the system? That, because, you know, I've been making the argument, and maybe you've got a better idea here, that what's being done right before our eyes is what the private sector has done to millions of people in this country, which is to make the situation so bad that you're running through bankruptcy court. A bankruptcy judge just writes it off and says, you can't pay it. You're broke. You don't have the money. Sorry, worker, you're screwed. This is government, you know, run by conservatives, run by Republicans, saying we've got to figure out how to do in the public sector what the private sector has been getting away with for at least a generation.
It goes much deeper than that. If you're an investor, there's certain pots of money you want. For instance, Social Security, and we'll start at the federal level. By the way, way, if you made $30,000 a year and you worked for 30 years, you'd paid in over $200,000 with interest. You're looking at $750,000. You can't collect it all. So the fallacy is that people get what they don't make. Anybody's paying into Social Security, it's 14%. Anybody listening, every paycheck is going, 7 from you and 7 from the employer. But you've got Social Security, huge amount of money.
Right.
You've got pension systems, huge amount of money. You've got school districts, huge amount of money. But the private sector isn't getting it. They can't get their hands on it to make money off of it. So how do you get your hands on it? You come up with a plan that you absolutely get people to hate the system that's in place. So if you're an investor, you want the state pension money. You want the employee's pension system. You want the mandate to come to you to buy off you so you make lots of money. If you're in the school system, you want education dollars to come into your pocket so you could make out on that. And by the way, you don't have to take the bad kids. You only get the good kids. If you're Social Security, you want that in the private sector. So it's even deeper than what you're talking about. A, we've got to make it so bad that the people ask for us to give to private business. Then B, the private businessmen understand this, and they see a huge pot of money that they can get their hands on and make a lot of money themselves off of. Because when you're an investor, you don't live or die off whether what you invest that money in makes money. You make a couple dollars off every transaction.
Yep.
That's how your money's made. So you're absolutely correct. It's a long-term plan with a strategy that's ingenious. And what scares me, it's beginning to work, and it's beginning to work very rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that scares me is there are so many people who say, well, I lost mine for them. And it's this race to the terminal velocity free fall to the bottom. It's not even a race. We're just plummeting to the bottom of this barrel. And you've got government now. You've got people who want to use government as the leaders of that. If we can get workers to work for less money, if we can steal their pensions, and we can do all of these things, you know, do away with education, do away with health care, do away with all the things that government has done so much better in their view.
I tell my son all the time, he's 25 years old, and I tell him, when you retire, you will retire with the poorest group of seniors that this nation has ever known, predating the Great Recession, because they're fighting to take everything you have away from you. You will have no Social Security, no retirement, no health care. And that's where it's coming to. And it's hard for you, especially young people, because they believe they're invincible and they believe they're going to live forever, understand how important these programs were done,
yep,
because of the Great Depression, because of the huge amount of poverty among seniors and the poor, and we're pushing ourselves back into that again. And I know you have to wrap up here soon, but one of the greatest telling tales of how much we don't have time to pay attention to what's going on, one of the things with gun control, we're talking about the mental health aspect of it, that we have these folks who are mentally ill getting guns out on the street. So what's the governor doing? The governor's talking about closing more state institutions where we need to keep people, and we're defunding more mental health programs, and we're not putting money into where it has to be. So we talk a good game, but at the end of the day, we're actually making things worse over the next few years rather than better.
Yeah, I know you're a pro-gun guy. What do you think of the debate going on right now?
I think the debate, if we really wanted to get serious about what's happening today, is that, A, we have to go into these neighborhoods, and we have to get these at-risk neighborhoods where there's no fathers, there's mothers who are having problems, whether it's drug and alcohol problems. We have kids who are in gangs. It's not like the gangs of the 80s. These kids are much more sophisticated. They're not killing themselves with assault rifles. They're killing themselves with those illegal pistols, those illegal guns, those straw guns that are being sold. If we really want to get serious about gun violence, we really have to get back to where what's important, those the mental health aspect of it. But we really have to go into these neighborhoods, and we have to work in these neighborhoods. We can't ignore them anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's a conversation we're not hearing anywhere. I mean, it's all the easy stuff, the background checks, the clip sizes, the the big guns. It's none of what you just said. And for me, it is that poverty. For me, it is the mental health issue. It's all of that stuff, and that's the hard stuff.
You're absolutely right. And until we take a serious look at our neighborhoods and go back into them again, I grew up at a time where we had the neighborhoods. They aren't there today. I grew up at a time to where your friend's mother would call your mother to make sure that things were done correctly if you weren't doing them the way they should be. I'll never get into some of the good times I had when I was younger. That's not there anymore. We have babies having babies more than ever. It's just the turmoil within these neighborhoods, and these kids have no hope whatsoever. The only way for them to survive is to get connected with a group of individuals. And normally it's troubled individuals, it's kids that are on drugs, it's kids that are in problems, because they absolutely, if you talk to these kids in high school, they have absolutely no hope for a future. And until we can get back in and we can educate these kids and we can go into these neighborhoods and we can give them a future again, this isn't going to end. In fact, it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, but we could give them charter schools, new shiny new charter schools with corporate books and iPads.
Well, what I said we can do is that since charter schools are, and again, I'm not against charter schools, but I am against the way we've set up the law so they can manipulate it. What I think we should do is pass a bill that since charter schools, some of these schools stand up and say how good they are at educating our children. I say what we do is we allow the schools to pick the children that get to go to them, not the charter school that gets to pick the kids that go to them.
Yeah, well, there's one way of going about it, or hold them to the same level of accountability.
Oh,
there's another one.
Well, we tried to do that a few times, but you know, some of the arguments you hear why we can't do that are absolutely amazing. I love when they bring in free market. We did a bill in education, free market, giving people plans to do anything. Well, we did a bill in education that when it comes to bidding on a school, you don't have to have small contractors. You only have to have a general. Now, if you had any understanding of business, and if you were pro-business, you voted against it because it took the small contractor out, the guy that couldn't be bonded for $1 million, who wouldn't be able to bid the way it is now. He can bid on the small electrical, the small plumbing, the small landscaping, but under their bill, he won't be able to bid anymore. So it contradicts everything they talk about. They talk about business, how they're putting small people out of business.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most of the time I listen to what they say, and up is down and back is forward. Now, the whole, it's a really bizarre world. I mean, last line of questioning I've got for you, in the coming days and weeks, we're going to hear a lot about this pension thing. Where do you see this going? Because, I keep hearing, and I've got friends telling me, Rick, we got a $41 billion unfunded liability, and, it's a huge albatross. And, what do you say to that? Because, I know what the answer is, but, this $41 billion number they keep throwing out.
Well, what you say on first is that, okay, we have an obligation. So you tell me how your plan fixes that $40 million obligation you talk about. You tell me about how not paying into it anymore, about not doing those payments that we're mandated to do, about starting a new system that, by the way, isn't any better than the old system, and West Virginia and other states that went to those systems, got rid of them because it bankrupted the state, but just ask them how they're planning on paying the obligation, how they're planning on moving forward. And they'll look at you with deer in the headlights, and they're going to have to go to the old line, we can't afford it. And that's one of the problems we're having, that it goes back to what I started out. They have these great one-liners, but at the end of the day, they have no policy to put forward to cure it.
Yep.
So what I always tell people, just ask them, what are you going to do with those retirees today? You want to defund the program. What are you going to do with them?
Don't care. It's my tax dollars. I don't care.
That's the one-liner. That's
the
exactly
answer
right.
I get. That's the answer I get, man.
Yep, and so, so we just let them starve, or they go on welfare. And that's one of the reason West Virginia and other states who did these programs, and that's what's most amazing about it. These programs that they're trying to bring forward for us to emulate didn't work. They did not work.
Because we didn't do them enough.
They're right. States that wanted to did it had to change back again. Liquor stores, problem is Washington State, they thought they were safe to use it because they thought, well, it's only been 6 months. There wouldn't be anything, any type of data out. Well, sure enough, the week we're doing, all the data comes out. How? Just to go back to it again, Washington State, alcohol prices went up. Surrounding states had an increase in sales because Washington wasn't competitive anymore. Small businesses went out of business because the big box stores took them out. Alcoholism increased, underage drinking increased. Oh, by the way, sales taxes went down, and they still wanted to, they still voted that plan, knowing full well, and as long as I'm going on, the governor stood up the day before that vote, told children at the Future Farmers of America, I was there, how this is going to put $1 billion in their education. $1 billion he's going to put in their education. When the bill came forward, which was the governor's plan, which he called the Governor Colley plan, we asked where the $1 billion was. Well, it's not $1 billion. A billion? No. Maybe 250,000. Does it go into education? No. None of it goes into education. Jeez. In fact, Daryl Metcalf just did a press conference saying that none of the money that they'd sell should go to education. He calls education the black hole. I mean, this is what we're dealing with. Sorry, I'm just rattling on, but this is what we're dealing with, that they aren't truthful. They aren't telling the facts. A day before a bill runs, we have a governor that stood in front of children and told them something that he knew wasn't true. And we passed a bill putting a $200 million budget, the shortfall in our budget, and not funding education. It is absolutely unbelievable.
It is absolutely maddening. And I've got the clip of Daryl Metcalf doing his, it's like throwing money in a big hole.
When you give money to the education establishment like this, it's like throwing it into a black hole.
Into a black hole.
Jeez. Nothing worse than educating children. You know, the next thing you know, they're going to read, they're going to write, they're going to get educated.
And they're not going to vote for you.
Yeah.
So I get it now. I get why Metcalf doesn't want kids educated, because no one in their right mind would vote for that guy. Scott, it's always great talking with you, man. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Hey, Rick, I enjoyed it. As always, you have a great show. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Scott Coughlin, Pennsylvania State Representative. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
AFSCME, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Growing up in small-town Texas, I quickly learned about fighting, including this valuable lesson. You should never hit a man with glasses. You should use something much heavier. This also applies to fighting for our good earth against rapacious profiteers, the spillers and spewers, frackers and extractors, drillers and pipeliners who view our environment, communities, health, and happiness as barriers to commerce that must be shoved aside. The heaviest tool we have for striking back is the indomitable human spirit that, when pushed, produces a fierce feistiness, tenacity, and organized resistance. I can even put a name to this spirit. Nancy Zorn. She's a 79-year-old grandmother from War Acres, Oklahoma, who's refusing to be shoved out of the way of ExxonMobil, TransCanada Corporation, and other giants that are trying to force the massive Keystone XL pipeline down America's throat. That pipeline would carry a nasty extra toxic sludge oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to oil export facilities in Port Arthur, Texas. The crude would be piped right through Oklahoma, where TransCanada already is underway with construction. Well, it was underway until Grandmother Zorn literally put her neck on the line. Using a bicycle lock on April 9th, she attached her own neck to one of TransCanada's huge earth-moving machines, halting construction. "I can no longer sit by idly," she declared. "It is time to rise up and defend our home. It is my hope that this one small action today will inspire many to protect this land and our water." This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, TransCanada had Nancy arrested, but it can't stop her and thousands of other spirited souls from continuing to fight this destructive corporate greed. Join them. They're organized as the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance at gptarsandsresistance.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. We could be the Texas of the Northeast. And the question I've got to ask you, do you really want to be? And I look at this explosion that happened last week, and I go, you know, the one thing that sticks in my mind is you go, you've got a school within 500 feet, you've got a nursing home within 1,000, 1,500 feet, and you've got a hospital within 2,500 feet from a fertilizer plant that, you know, any rational person would go, well, wait a second, I remember the Murrah building going up. Boom. Do we want that by a school, by a nursing home, and by a hospital? The answer is no. Anyway, Workers' Memorial Day is coming up April 28th, which is why we've asked Barbara Reiki, director of Philiposh, to come talk to us about Workers' Memorial Day. And also, you know, just this idea, do we need to have a fertilizer plant that close to a school? Maybe we should have someone look at the plate. In the last 26 years, just a thought. Barbara, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for asking me.
You know, I look at this tragedy in West Texas, and, you know, I go, you know, could this have been avoided? I don't know. But this close to a school, to a nursing home, does that make any sense?
Well, I think, you know, when you have the attitude that regulation is unnecessary and that, you know, some dead work, some dead residents, some destroyed families is just collateral. They don't really care. It's unfortunately you can find that same scenario many places around the country.
Yeah, and I look here in Pennsylvania, and you look across the country. You know, thousands of workers die every year. Tens of thousands die every year from occupational illnesses because we just don't really keep track of that stuff. And for me, instead of deregulating and pulling inspectors back, we should be doing more of this to be protecting workers and their families.
And I think, as you know, there are so few inspectors that to be able to inspect every deemed dangerous, you know, highly hazardous workplace would take, you know, dozens and dozens, I think over 90 years to be inspected one time. So it's as much headway as we've made, thanks to passage of OSHA and different state plans, we are woefully underfunded and doing what needs to be done.
Could what happened in West Texas happen here in Pennsylvania?
You know, no question about it. I mean, I think Texas is, I a few years ago, I was at a BP refinery and, where 15 had died, not long before that, and the steelworkers were giving us a tour. And what amazed me was, again, you had that same scenario there, but management bought an old closed, Walmart store. To move 4 miles away. They left the residents close by, but in case there was another explosion, they moved 4 miles away. So, yeah, you know, this year we've spent the whole year tracking worker deaths in Pennsylvania. We put a fatality list together. We've identified 100 who died in Pennsylvania alone, and that does not count the workers that die from injuries, because that's not, I mean, from illnesses, which isn't tracked.
Right.
But that's without any one big catastrophic incident. We still have 100 worker deaths that we've been able to identify so far.
In the last year?
In the last year,
wow.
Correct.
And, you know, with Workers' Memorial coming up on April 28th, you know, you look at this and you take that moment to look back and you go, all these people who've lost their lives, just doing what all of us want to do every day, just getting up, going, punching the clock and trying to support our families.
And you know, it doesn't matter how dangerous a job you're in. You can't get up in the morning and go to work every day if you focus on the fact that you may not be home. And so for each one of these families who have lost somebody, and let me say on the list we have just put together, they range in age from 14 years of age to 71 years of age,
14.
And everything in between.
14? What is a 14-year-old doing?
Well, usually every year we see 12, 13, 14-year-olds. It's always farm deaths.
Right.
In this particular case, a whole family died in a manure lagoon, a 14-year-old, an 18-year-old, and I guess the father, he was 50. And then what's a 71-year-old doing out on construction sites? Still getting killed. I mean, in both cases, you know, but they're also 21 years old, they're 24 years old, they're 40 years old. It's all preventable deaths and everyone tragic.
Yeah, I mean, are there any that aren't preventable in your view? I mean, because I'm of the mindset all injuries can be prevented if you just took the right course of action and had the right oversight.
Absolutely, and more and more what we see happening, which is really troubling, is that we're going turning the clock back in time where workers are de facto responsible for the injuries that they suffer, and looking at the root cause of what could have been done to prevent this is the last thing that's looked at. We're getting more and more reports of workplaces where workers get injured and they immediately get a letter saying you were not aware of your surroundings. If you get injured again, we're going to discipline you.
Yep.
Now, how is that kind of system going to make a safer workplace? It's not.
Well, I've been saying for the longest time we're going, I believe, the big compromise of taking my constitutional rights to sue away. That compromise has been broken because, as you pointed out, employers are now placing blame on workers and disciplining them for things that, you know, were outside of their control, and I've known several people it's happened to.
Right. It is. It is alarming what's beginning to happen. The other trend we're seeing, which is alarming, is the number of temporary workers that are getting killed, because the word temporary is a joke now when people have to go through temp agencies to get hired. And then they may be there for years, but they fall outside the scope of safety training, of preparation. The last death we recorded for this cycle, we end on March 1st. It was a temporary worker, his first day on the job working at a sugar refinery in Pennsylvania. So that's another bad trend.
Absolutely horrible. What should we be doing to make sure that this doesn't happen and we remember these people and not in vain, that we remember them and try and move forward so that it doesn't happen to someone else?
Well, we adhere to the Mother Jones slogan, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. And that includes, in our opinion, one, being aware, and two, holding our legislators accountable and demanding stronger regulations, not weaker regulations, demanding standards, combustible dust standard, the silica standard, the ergonomic standard, all things that we're still waiting to get implemented that are being blocked by our Congress. So we have to be aware and we have to start holding people accountable.
Yep, we've got to be up on things. We've got to be pushing, and we've got to remember those who have passed. Barbara,
right.
I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for putting this on the air. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Anytime, Barbara Reiki, director of Philiposh. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around.
Save the USA. It's drowning in grass and lies. Save the USA. Every Zoomer ties it fine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job you're looking for.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
April 16th was National Library Workers' Day, and AFSCME, which represents 25,000 library workers nationwide, held celebrations, including one on the steps of the downtown library in New Haven, Connecticut. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
AFSCME represents 40 workers in the New Haven system. Librarian Bill Armstrong mentioned some of the things the library can do for patrons.
We can help you find out how to bake a cake, fix your car, and play the guitar. In short, we help you do the things you want and need to do to improve and enrich your lives, and if we can't, we'll find someone for you who can.
The last comment may have been a reference to four Connecticut librarians' courageous refusal to honor the conditions of a national security letter sent out during the Bush administration, which demanded that librarians turn over information on patrons' library use as part of the war on terror and not reveal their actions to anyone on pain of prosecution. They were eventually vindicated and not prosecuted. Others spoke of all the cultural and educational programming that's available at the main location and at the city's four branch libraries. Things like reading hour for babies, English classes for immigrants, computer instruction, and help with job searches. 10-year-old Alejandro Lopez also spoke in praise of librarians. He said his mom has been bringing him to the library for years because his whole family loves to read.
In the Fairhaven Library, she can get her books in Spanish, and I get my fiction and nonfiction books and movies. The staff there is always friendly and helpful.
As budget cuts come and go, library hours have been cut back and workers laid off. Many residents say libraries should be the last thing to be cut, since they serve such a fundamental role in the life of a democracy, and since patrons tend toward those of lower income who have less access to computers. Melissa Canham Klein said she became a librarian because of the wonderful staff she met at her branch library. She began as a volunteer, then a part-time worker.
I started at the very lowest level of the library, and my brothers and sisters of Locals 31, 44, and 884, they took me from that lowest level on up. They believed in me. They taught me the skills I need. I went to library school to learn the rudiments of being a librarian, but I learned the practice of librarianship from these people here. Thank you.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Think of my for the new revolution. Smile and green with the change all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Our quote of the day from Robert Reich, former labor secretary, in his piece, The Disuniting of America. Something caught my eye in it. He says, you know, being wealthy in modern America, it means you don't have to come across anyone who isn't. And to me, that was really one of those things that just grabbed me and goes, you know, it's that two Americas. And even more so, the splintering of the very wealthy into their gated communities and their private estates, and then the rest of us. And how are the rest of us going to deal? I mean, what we've been seeing across this state and across the country is you've got governors like ours who have budgets that, well, we're going to slash programs for the poor. We're going to slash programs for the disabled. And while slashing those programs, basically ending their ability to stay in their homes. Then what they've done is with the closing, the slashing of budgets, they've closed the homes that these folks would have gone to as well. So where do they end up? Well, the streets. And what's wrong with that, right? At least that's what our Republican friends tell me. And it's just mind-blowing, which is why I want to see more people in the streets. And today I understand the ADAPT people delivered a report card on the administration's interaction with the disabled, with the disability community, and gave the Obama administration failing grades. I've got Mike Irvine from the Chicago ADAPT to talk about this today's action and the week of action and what they hope to accomplish. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having us.
So tell me what happened. You went to the White House today to deliver a report card, or ADAPT did. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, we went to the White House. We had a very large report card. It was ADAPT's School of Disability Justice report card on President Obama and for leadership, integrity, and engagement, getting an F on all three fronts. And we only got as far as 17th in Pennsylvania initially, and we had a big loud protest, about 200 people, most of them with disabilities out there. And then while the police weren't looking, we moved the yellow tape, and a bunch of people charged the White House and were able to get up to the gate and attach themselves to the gate of the White House. About 40 people got arrested. And it's part of our ongoing dispute with not just the administrative branch, but all the branches of the government, the way that they skew Medicaid policy to make it so that it's very difficult for people like me who have disabilities and need assistance in our home to get it in our home, instead making it to where we have to go to nursing homes, places we don't want to go to. And we object to that very vociferously, and budget cuts are making it worse across the country. And we're here to speak as loud and clear as we can and let everybody know that that's not acceptable.
Well, you should be against it. You know, the sad reality is you've had states all across this country following the same playbook, and it's not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's what they've been pursuing. And for me, you know, I would want you to stay in your home, because I know that you're going to lead a much more fulfilling life, less costly as well, I would assume, than having to be institutionalized. Or am I missing something?
No, that's absolutely true, but unfortunately, nursing homes are a big business. They make billions of dollars every year, and those billions come from Medicaid. And how they make that money is they keep us captive. They make it so that we have no choice but to go to them. And when you give us freedom of choice, most people would choose not to go to nursing homes. So the Medicaid laws are skewed, and that segment of the wealthy works very hard to keep it that way.
You know, to me, I look at a person and how they deal with the most vulnerable. And I look at our governor and I look at our president and I look at all of these politicians and the views that they have towards our kids, towards our elderly, towards our disabled, and how their policies and their budgets and their priorities, how those things line up. And I got to be honest, I'm not happy with what I'm seeing, and I know you're not either.
No, that's why we're here. That's why we had 40 people arrested today, and we often do that. You know, someone like me, as I said, I use a motorized wheelchair, and I live in Illinois, and my state government has a program where I can hire someone to come into my home and help me, and I get to choose who that person is, and I get to pay them myself using state money. Otherwise, I would have to go to a nursing home, and then I would give up all my rights. I would give up all my possessions. I have about 10 square feet of private space, and not even private. No one wants to live in a nursing home, and there's a reason why.
No.
So there's an institutional bias in Medicaid that makes it the states are required to pay for that, but they're not required to pay to give us the choice to keep us in our homes, and that's where we're always fighting to change.
And that just doesn't make any sense to me because, you know, the studies that I've read show that it's cheaper. I mean, if you're just looking at it from a fiscal point of view, it's cheaper to keep you in your home. It's cheaper to have you being cared for by someone who comes and visits. And beyond that, it gives you a reason to wake up in the morning to be somewhat as self-sufficient as you can possibly be and lead the kind of life that you can lead.
It allows you to be productive. I work every day, and the people who get me up in the morning allow me to do those things. My wife also has a disability. She works every day, and the people that help her to get up in the morning do that. So the only people that benefit from the incarceration in nursing homes are the people that own the nursing home.
That's a way of putting it.
That's why it's so unfair.
That's an interesting way of putting it, and I've never thought of it in that way before. You're basically being incarcerated without beyond your will. I mean, that's a perfect frame for that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you get sentenced in there, and it's almost impossible to get out. They take all your money. They leave you with a whole $30 a month to spend. You have no possessions, and you'll oftentimes have no rights. They tell you when to come and go, and you're an adult. You can't eat what you want to. You can't eat when you want to. There's a reason why nobody wants to live in those places. And if you or someone you loved ended up with a disability, you would very much want to have the freedom to stay in your home. Everybody would. It makes total sense. But yet, you know, policies are skewed because of who they benefit. Fortunately, we've been fighting this battle for about 20 years. We've made a lot of progress. Things are a lot better than they used to be. But austerity threatens us going backwards. That's what we're seeing in a lot of states. And that's what's scaring us today.
Mike, you find that it seems to be easier to cut budgets to folks like you? Because I look at the cuts that our governor has proposed over the years and the things that he's done. It's always to the most vulnerable. It's to the children. It's to the seniors. It's to groups like yours, because they seem, well, easier.
Yeah, they think we can't fight back, you know, and that's who it is. That's who they're going to go after, is the people that will give them the best fight. They think that, we're incapable of speaking up for ourselves and standing up for ourselves. And, you know, I think we're demonstrating that they're wrong about that.
And good
when
for
people
you.
Do listen, when they think about it in terms of someone they love or them being in a nursing home, it makes perfect sense, and they understand it, and 99% of the time they're on our side.
Because I'll tell you what I think, Mike, and how I view this is, you know, at any moment, I could be in a situation akin to yours. At any second, I could, you know, I could be standing on a curb and someone could hit me and I'd be paralyzed, or I could have some disease that it would take my ability to walk and do all those things away as well. I mean, there are so many things that could happen to me or to my family that, you know, I would want to make sure that there's this safety net to make sure that, you know, that they have some respect, some dignity, and I think that's all you're looking for.
That's all we're looking for, and we're even saying take the same money that you're spending now and let people choose to use it in a different way. We're not even saying adding extra money. We're saying that if people are eligible for coverage for skilled nursing care in a nursing home, that they should be able to have the ability to say, I want that money spent in another way. I want to use it to hire people to work for me in my home. And it makes sense all the way around.
Tell me about yourself. I mean, you know, the situation that you find yourself in, if you were, because I guess the question that I'm looking for is, you know, what level of disability are you? Is a nursing home somewhere where you could potentially end up? Explain that to me.
Yeah, I could easily. If a program like that was cut, that's where I could easily go. Fortunately, I would go kicking and screaming, and, you know, I think that's my best defense. But I use a motorized wheelchair. I have to have assistance getting in and out of bed every morning. I have to have assistance getting dressed. And once I'm in my chair and I'm out and about, I do pretty well. But, you know, I need people to help me with the things that everybody does every day. Just think about what you do every morning when you get up and what you do every night when you go to bed. And I need assistance with all those things. Now, most people will look at that and say, wow, that guy is really in bad shape. I'm glad I'm not him. Someone like him would end up in a nursing home. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. We just look at things differently and we care more about what happens to people. We can design different systems, and that's what ADAPT is all about.
Now, I'm always reminded of a couple of my friends who are who tend to wear their religiosity on their sleeves and tell me that we're this grand Christian nation. And I look at things like this and I have to wonder.
Yeah, me too. But really, it really does come down to money and who benefits from it. And the people that make a lot of money like to put forth the myth that folks with disabilities are incapable of making their own decisions, are incapable of running their own lives. And I like to keep that myth going because that's what allows the mistreatment that takes away people's freedom of choice and gives them no choice but to go into a nursing home. Yeah, I would, and again, hopefully when you see a DAPS on the street, they'll change your mind about that.
Yeah, I would think that you're fully capable of making up your own mind. You might not be able to put your socks on, but you can decide which direction you want to go with your life, and I think you should have the right to do that.
I can decide who puts my socks on and when and how. And, you know, those are all little decisions, but if you think about having those taken away from you, they don't seem so little anymore.
Absolutely. So what do you want us doing? What do you want our listeners? What do you want me doing? What's the push here?
Well, we're going to be doing things throughout the week. And, hopefully if you, hear about where we are, you can let the specific, department that we're at, the department where we are, know that you're on our side. But I think in general what you need to do is when you hear about issues like Medicare being cut, and when you hear about mostly with Medicare and Medicaid being cut and austerity, that kind of thing, you need to let your legislators know that you don't agree with that people with disabilities rely on Medicare quite a bit and Medicaid quite a bit, and that to cut it back rather than to actually make it more generous is the wrong way to go. But the main thing is the institutional bias that's in Medicaid that says that it can pay for someone to be in a nursing home but not to live in their own homes, and to let your legislators and those who make policy in your area know that you think that that's wrong and that it needs to change is a real helpful thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's wrong, not just for people with disabilities, but for seniors as well. And I think of my grandmother, who, you know, has a heart condition and there has to be somebody with her most of the day. You know, they wanted to put her in a nursing home unless the family could have someone there all the time. And I'm like, you know, she's perfectly functional. She's perfectly able to do a whole bunch of things on her own. Doesn't want to go anywhere near a nursing home, but you're absolutely right. And I guess I hadn't thought of it in those terms, with the disabled. I had just thought about it in the world that I see.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we're all sort of caught up in the same, vortex there.
Yep.
It affects seniors quite a bit too.
Yeah, well, I wish you the best. I wish you the best. I hope our listeners will contact their representatives. And if there's anything else you want to come back and talk to me about, you've got a friend here.
All right. We appreciate it. We'll be out doing a couple more days of actions. We'll be letting you know what we're doing, and we really appreciate your support.
I look forward to hearing about it. Mike, thanks so much. Mike Irvine from Chicago Adapt. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Growing up in small town Texas, I quickly learned about fighting, including this valuable lesson. You should never hit a man with glasses. You should use something much heavier. This also applies to fighting for our good earth against rapacious profiteers, the spillers and spewers, frackers and extractors, drillers and pipeliners who view our environment, communities, health, and happiness as barriers to commerce that must be shoved aside. The heaviest tool we have for striking back is the indomitable human spirit that, when pushed, produces a fierce feistiness, tenacity, and organized resistance. I can even put a name to this spirit. Nancy Zorn. She's a 79-year-old grandmother from War Acres, Oklahoma, who's refusing to be shoved out of the way of ExxonMobil, TransCanada Corporation, and other giants that are trying to force the massive Keystone XL pipeline down America's throat. That pipeline would carry a nasty extra-toxic sludge oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to oil export facilities in Port Arthur, Texas. The crude would be piped right through Oklahoma, where TransCanada already is underway with construction. Well, it was underway until Grandmother Zorn literally put her neck on the line. Using a bicycle lock on April 9th, she attached her own neck to one of TransCanada's huge earth-moving machines, halting construction. "I can no longer sit by idly," she declared. "It is time to rise up and defend our home. It is my hope that this one small action today will inspire many to protect this land and our water." This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, TransCanada had Nancy arrested, but it can't stop her and thousands of other spirited souls from continuing to fight this destructive corporate greed. Join them. They're organized as the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance at gptarsandsresistance.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Rebels are we. Though heavy our hearts shall always be. Ah, no ball or chain, no prison shall keep rid of rebels and a sacred heart. Except the ball or chain, no prison shall keep rid of rebels and a sacred heart.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Dean Baker had an interesting observation. You look at the nation's top 1% has seen their percentage of income jump by over 10% since the late 70s. And you look at this massive redistribution of wealth upward. Dean Baker points out that it has roughly the same impact on the living standards of ordinary workers as doubling all federal taxes. And that's kind of it's an interesting way of looking at it. The fact that we have seen our wages continually decline while productivity is going up is really, while taxes have stayed the same for most working people, is actually a tax increase. It's an interesting way of thinking about it. As we give more to the very top and all the breaks go to them, you know, screw you and me. And all of this austerity, all of this screwquester, who's it hurting? Well, it's hurting people at the very bottom. And to me, you've got one political party, the entire party to blame, and a good number of the other political party to blame as well for being the ones who aren't willing to go out there and fight for it. And I go back to the Misek piece that I cited at the beginning of the show when he's talking about the cowardly Democrats, the handful of cowardly Democrats who voted against the Toomey Manchin gun bill. Sane, rational regulation. They voted against it. And Misek said, you know, they're, you know, basically cowards and spineless and, you know, fools and the such. And, you know, didn't bother to say anything about the Republicans, which you would think, yeah, they are the fools. You're not going to get anything out of them. And I look at this story out of Arkansas, and it brings me back to this idea of, you know, in talking with Mike there a minute ago about Medicaid. You've got these rabid right-wingers. We've got one here in Pennsylvania sitting in the governor's mansion who refuses to take the Medicaid money. Hundreds of thousands of people could get some measure of insurance so that they have some health security. But dead set against ideology over reality. And there are other Republicans just fuming that their state would even consider taking the Medicaid money. Well, Arkansas is considering taking the money. The state legislature has voted to, you know, to expand Medicaid under Obamacare. So what did the Republican Party head there in Benton County, Arkansas, what did he do? Well, they sent out a letter. Had a couple interesting quotes in it. Where he asked about what to do. He asked the people who were reading, what do we do about this expansion? He said, well, I believe that we as a party are done in Arkansas after this. If there is any hope of our survival, it's going to take not being forgiving. Not only for past actions, but to show that those who will come in the future, that the cost of failure to do the things that they were elected to do will be significant. He goes on to say, we need to let those who will come in the future to represent us know that we're serious and represent us that we are serious. He said the Second Amendment means nothing unless those in power believe you would have no problem simply walking up and shooting them if they got too far out of line and stopped responding as representatives. He said, personally, I think a gun is quicker and more merciful, but hey, we can't. Immediately after this came out, now think about the timing of this. You just have what happened in Boston, where you've got police in that area going, we have no idea how they got a hold of so much armament, how they got so much ammunition and nobody noticed, how they got all of this stuff stockpiled. All we have no idea how it happened. I look at this statement, and look, you know, the guy says, well, you know, my wife, the secretary, she sent it without permission. I'm sure there's going to be an interesting discussion about divorce going on there. But, you know, and it's all this backpedaling and all of this stuff. And I go, you know, that's fine, whatever. But even to sit and put this down pen to paper and think of sending this out to who knows who, how many of these, because for me what scares me in all of this is that there are people who are going to look at what happened in Boston and go, there's an idea. And they see all this stuff, and there's an idea. And they're going to read this guy who they follow and say, hey, there's an idea. It's extremely troublesome to me. And especially when you look at, you know, it's nothing. This heated rhetoric, I guess, is nothing new. But you remember after what happened in Boston, one of their state representatives tweeted out that he bet the cowardly liberals were wishing that they had an AR-15 with a high-capacity magazine there in Boston. He apologized later. But, you know, you go, explain this to me. Walk me through this on a sane, rational level. Let's say all of those people at the finish line had an AR-15. Let's say they were armed to the teeth. What would they have stopped? I mean, think about that for a second. I think what would have happened is you'd have seen a lot of people shooting at nothing and hitting a lot of other people. And I think, you know, I think Scott Conklin's right. You know, to me, and I've talked about this before, you know, the mental health aspect of it, but the poverty aspect of it as well. There's a lot to this, but that would take work, wouldn't it? I don't know. Let's take a quick break. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
On a dark night where you can see the band of the Milky Way arching overhead, look closely. There are pockets between the stars where the light seems to be missing.
But this seemingly empty space between the stars isn't really empty. It is much emptier than anything here on Earth. But nearly one-sixth of the mass of our home galaxy, the Milky Way, lives in the space between the stars. The stuff between stars is called interstellar medium. It contains ingredients for making new planets, asteroids, and stars.
The space between stars, the interstellar medium, is 99% gas. About three-quarters of that gas is hydrogen, the thermonuclear fuel that powers our sun and all stars for most of their lives.
The other 1% of the space between stars is interstellar dust. This dust in space consists of grains of ice, carbon compounds, and silicate. The interstellar medium is shaped by stellar winds, dying stars, the magnetic fields of galaxies, and vast supernova explosions.
All that matter and activity, and yet most of the stuff between stars, is invisible to our eyes. Modern astronomers explore the interstellar medium using special kinds of telescopes, sensitive to radiation in the radio, infrared, and X-ray parts of the spectrum. Come to EarthSky.org and search for the words interstellar medium to learn more. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
There is no other agency like the EPA. It should really be renamed the Job-Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground.
The Job-Killing Organization of America, because those people want you to breathe air and drink water and, well, grass and trees. I got an excellent email. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you want to email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. But I got this great email. Bob sent me this email saying, Did you know, Rick? Today, April 22nd, Earth Day. It's also the birthday of Vladimir Lenin and the National Day of Communism in the USSR. Did you know that? Did you know that the Earth Day and the commies are hand in hand? And of course it's not, but I love that hey, if you don't like it, demonize it. Destroy it. Do whatever you can to demonize it. Which is why I have asked Franklin Russell, director of Earth Day at the Earth Day Network, to come talk to us. Franklin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, glad to be here.
So today, in addition to being Earth Day, as I'm told by Bob, it is Vladimir Lenin, his birthday, and the National Day of Communism in the USSR. And he's trying to make a coalition. Anything there?
Well, actually, I don't think so. there was some confusion, I think, always been over the years and early on, but no, they are two separate and distinct events.
I think the answer is hell no. What are you, stupid? Why did you ask such a dumb question? It's ridiculous. But you know the thing that gets me, and this is one of those things that just blows my mind. You know, if you have these two dates that match up, see, there's something there. It's part of the conspiracy. It's those tree huggers. They want to take over the world and make us all breathe air. Not going there with me?
Well, I think you said it correctly. It's, right. There's nothing really between the two events. They're two separate things.
All right. So today is Earth Day. How many years have we been doing Earth Day now?
Well, believe it or not, it's actually the 43rd anniversary of Earth Day. So, you know, the first Earth Day was in 1970, April 22nd. Today, 43 years later, we've got a billion people participating in over 192 countries around the world. It's the world's largest secular event.
Wow, that's huge, and it's increasing every year.
That's correct, yeah. The first Earth Day in 1970, 20 million Americans came out. And, you know, we've seen in 1990 it went international, went into over 100 countries. And today, as I mentioned, we're in 192 countries with over a billion people doing something.
That's incredible. And out of all of this awareness, you know, to me, I give credit to the whole recycling and the consciousness about reusing and all of that stuff because our landfills are filling up. And, you know, I got to be honest, I would like to drink clean water and breathe clean air.
Yeah, you know, I think it's probably a right that we all have.
So in looking at this, you know, and the action's increasing, we're seeing these number of people out in the streets. What are we pushing for? What's the goal of Earth Day as you see it?
Well, this year we've identified the theme as the face of climate change. And Earth Day every year on April 22nd, it's all about protecting the environment, taking action, and really building a movement. This year the theme is the face of climate change. And the reason it is that is because climate change was one of the most pressing concerns of our time. And unfortunately, there are a lot of folks around the world who just aren't aware of it. So what we're trying to do this year for Earth Day is go out there and start collecting stories, collecting photographs from people, hearing about how climate change is impacting them and what they're doing to be part of the solution. We're trying to put together this global digital mosaic that captures all these different stories so that we can share them with the rest of the world and hopefully educate the rest of the world and also inspire our leaders to start taking action.
You know, what do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, that it's getting warmer because that's just the natural things, the way things are done. And all of the do-gooders and all those people, they just want to slow down the economy and ruin things.
Well, look, so we'll look at the facts right now. Over the past century, the Earth's temperature has increased by 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit or 0.8 degrees Celsius. Now, that's agreed to by over 90% of climate scientists. So that's happening. And, you know, how are humans involved? Well, humans have been emitting greenhouse gases fairly frequently for this past century. We've emitted several hundred billion metric tons of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Now, normally, greenhouse gases are actually beneficial to the planet if they're in small amounts.
Right.
Greenhouse gases provide a blanket of sorts that trap the heat that allow heat or life to be successful here on Earth. However, we're getting to the point that we're putting so many greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere, that blanket's becoming thicker and thicker. It's affecting the temperature, and the temperature change is therefore influencing our climate and also our weather.
Well, how much do you think that has to do with the size of our population? I mean, the planet keeps growing. I mean, the number of people keep growing. I don't think there's ever been as many people on this planet as there is now. How much of that do you think contributes?
Well, so looking at those greenhouse gases, by far the biggest emitter is actually the burning of fossil fuels for energy. Now, there's also, you know, deforestation, agricultural practices, industrial processes, and individual activities. So, yes, for every person that does come onto the Earth, if we all want to use the same cars, if we all want to use the same electricity, that is going to go up until we find renewable energy and other sustainable measures to start living. So you're right, population does play an impact. Really, the biggest thing out there is the burning of fossil fuels.
So that's something that government policy could actually have some pretty good say on. I mean, we could be moving towards renewables and getting away from burning stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, as he's put it, everyone wants clean air, clean water. And if we're not careful, if we don't start taking action now and start reducing these greenhouse gases, we're going to be facing permanent change in weather and in climate. So we're going to see more and more droughts, more and more severe heat waves, more superstorms. We're going to see our glaciers disappearing, sea levels rising. It's not going to be the Earth that we grew up on.
Well, what do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, you started off, Franklin, with, well, you know, it's global warming and things are getting hotter. But, you know, we had a cold winter. It's still cold outside. What do you say to the people who say, well, you know, it's not getting that much warmer? Because I hear people saying, well, you know, now it's climate change. Now we're having these events where storms are much worse and there's wider swings between. Where are we now with all of this?
Well, so climate change, it's not going to happen overnight, and you can't relate any single real event to climate change. So what climate change really does is it's the increase in temperature, it's building an environment that becomes less and less stable. And so really, the best analogy I've heard is when comparing it to baseball. If you have a baseball player who is taking steroids, now, does that mean every steroid he takes is going to hit a home run for each steroid he takes? No, it's not the case at all. But, you know, for every steroid he takes, the more and more he takes of them, the more likely he's going to hit a home run and be, a superstar. So, you can kind of take that analogy and take it over to climate change. As temperatures increase, and again, this is kind of gradual over time, over the years, but as temperatures increase, the water gets warmer in the ocean, so it's easier to evaporate. And the consequence is that, we have more droughts. In some places, in other places, we have torrential downpours leads to floods. And just it messes with the whole ecological system here on Earth.
Who are the people being harmed most by this right now? Who are the people that are being harmed right now? Because, I know people who say, well, we're not going to be that harmed by it. We live in Pennsylvania. We might get beachfront property at some point, but, well, we'll be fine.
It's the people in the least developed areas and the least developed countries who are the ones who are suffering the most right now. There are different parts of the world that just don't have the capability to deal with these superstorms or to deal with those droughts and those floods. So when those happen more frequently, they're devastating. Thinking about some of the island countries out there, like the Maldives, there are, families right now are having to consider relocating their homes, because the sea level's rising, and pretty soon that beachfront property is no longer going to be there. Even here in the U.S., there are going to be more droughts. We had Superstorm Sandy hit recently. Things like that are just going to become more and more frequent. So, yes, maybe we haven't received the brunt of climate change and its impact yet, but we will. And so that's why, with our theme this year, The Face of Climate Change, we're trying to capture these stories and images from around the world so that we can share them with our friends and our family who haven't witnessed climate change yet, and hopefully inspire us to start taking more action.
Yeah, because, for me, it's easy to listen to the James Inhofe's of the world. Oh, it's just a hoax. And to think we could live exactly as we've been, consume as much as we want, and there are no repercussions. There's no consequence.
Well, and, that's the thing is there are consequences, and we need to start taking action. So, everyone wants to have a clean backyard. Everyone wants to have clean air. And if we don't start doing something soon, as I mentioned, we're going to be hitting a threshold where we're not going to be able to get back to where where things were when we grew up. So
is it possible? Is that possible? I mean, is it possible to go backwards? I mean, part of what I've seen is, we're just going to slow the process. But I'm almost of the mindset that, it's too late.
Well, we're getting very, very close to that point. I think it kind of depends on the scientists and who you talk to, but some folks are saying that really, the tipping point for in terms of greenhouse gas emissions we can have in the atmosphere is close to 1,000 or roughly a trillion metric tons. And we have pretty much gotten to a third of the way there. So we are quickly running out of greenhouse gas emissions that we can emit. And if, if we're not careful, if we keep burning these fossil fuels, we are going to hit that threshold, and then it'll be the point of no return. And, those parks that we got to enjoy as kids and know, they're not going to be there. Our grandkids aren't going to have that. It's going to be an entirely different world.
You know, I remember a quote by Rex Tillerson, the CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil, who said, you know, it's happening. Climate change is happening. But we're just going to engineer our way out of it. And there's this view that, yeah, it's coming. Yeah, it's no big deal. We'll figure out how to deal with it when it gets here.
Well, you know, there's a reason why, you know, the U.S. military has named climate change as one of the biggest threats facing U.S. moving forward. You know, there's a reason why all the government agencies in the U.S. are starting to devote time and resources to looking at climate change and starting to address it. There's a reason why there are United Nations climate talks that are happening every year. You know, people everywhere are concerned about this. And the thing is there's just not enough public support yet to start influencing change. Once we get the climate movement really going, that's what we're hoping to do with the face of climate change. That's how we're going to influence change. We need, you know, the everyday person to step up and let people know that, you know, this is important to them. We need to start taking action. We need to make sure that we preserve the future for our children.
Yeah, I'm with him. So what's the ask? What are we telling people today? What do our listeners, what's the ask on Earth Day?
Well, I think at this point it might be a little too late to attend an Earth Day event. So what I would encourage people to do is to take a picture of themselves and maybe something that they're doing for the planet, whether that's maybe recycling, composting, maybe doing something in the home that helps reduce your carbon footprint, or take a picture of how climate change is impacting you and your community and send it to us. If you go to earthday.org/2013, we're building this digital mosaic that's captured thousands of pictures of people around the world over these past couple of weeks. We're hoping to display that in front of leaders around the world and hopefully inspire them to start taking action.
Well, I'll have to take a picture with me and my solar panels, because I got solar panels a couple years ago, and I love them.
Oh, they're great. And, I mean, if you can pull it off, it actually, you know, they make electricity cheaper, you know, it's better for the planet. It's a win-win.
Yeah, if only I can get the state legislature to pass the piece of legislation to help bring back the SREC credits. It would help revitalize the industry and get more people towards it again, back to that whole policy thing. But while we've got the Republicans we've got in office, that's not going to happen. Frustrating on so many levels. But Franklin, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the information.
Well, thanks, Rick. Happy Earth Day.
All right. Happy Earth Day to you, my friend. Franklin Russell, director of Earth Day. The Earth Day Network is their site, earthday.org, the website. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Majority. Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together, we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app. Take the program on the go. If you've got anything in your mind, love to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. New piece of research published in the Psychological Science magazine back at the end of March, where they concluded that the people who have this, that reject things like climate change or reject facts, tend to be the free market types. Oh, you need to let get your hands off the economy. Let the invisible hand do the work. And I guess you could take that the next step further and go, well, you know, the people who have the hyper religious view of, you know, of the angry God and that he'll take care of everything would view everything else in the same light. And Stephen Ladowski, he is a writer for, and a professor at the University of Western Australia. He was one of the people who wrote this piece, and he said, in it, he said, you know, the conspiracists' ideation is that all the world scientific academies have conspired. They've conspired together to create a hoax known as global warming, has found traction in the American mainstream politics. He said the pivotal role of personal ideology in the rejection of climate science has been repeatedly demonstrated. He said, we highlighted the magnitude of this effect among climate science blog denizens who have a strong interest in the issue. And we additionally showed that the endorsement of the free market also predicted the rejection of two other well-established scientific facts. And I look at this and I go, well, there's nothing really surprising in this for me. The people who are the ones who deny, you know, look at James Inhofe, and I use him often because he's one of the guys that, you know, there are thousands of these scientists all independently working to perpetuate the greatest hoax. And the only reason that they're going to do it is because they want more regulation. And I've always thought, look, and this is one of those things that I believe on a lot of levels. Not just when you're talking about global warming or pollution or If you're going to have an economy, businesses should not be free riders. They should not be benefiting from passing the externalities of their business onto the taxpayer or onto somebody else. And what I mean by that is if their product has a negative effect on society, they should be held to account. And I use cigarettes as one of those things that the externalities have been put off on the rest of us. And I know all my smoking friends are going to lose their mind because, oh, he's talking bad about cigarettes. My health insurance goes up because people smoke. Because we know if you use the product as they say to, you're going to have breathing problems that's going to cost the healthcare system a ton of money. And you can make that argument for a lot of things. And look, I'm right there with you. If the fat guy ate fast food. Yes, you make that expensive enough that the tax base covers the cost for the heart attack he's going to have after he eats the fast food. I'm with you. Same thing with soda. I'm not going to stop drinking Coke or Pepsi or any cold. I'm not going to stop drinking it. I'm not. Because I'm stubborn, my wife and my 4-year-old would argue stupid, because I'm hooked on the stuff. I do believe, though, it should be more expensive, and we should cover the external costs that I'm going to incur. All across the board, this idea that we can pass along the costs to someone else is just mind blowing to me. Because it's everything the right wing tells us they're not. Well, you know, we believe in the free market. No, that's not the free market. You've set up a system where this business gets a benefit, a subsidy, a massive subsidy in not being held responsible for what their product does. The free market would say, well, your product has a pollution, obesity, heart attacks, whatever. You've got to bear that cost. That cost cannot and should not be borne by society. Just a thought. So when I look at this piece of research that they've done, and look, they're the ones who, you know, studied all of the, almost 1,400 people, and found that, you know what, the majority of them, yeah, they were the laissez-faire types. And you go and you look at all of this stuff, you know. It's all of this worldview that, well, you know, the free market will take care of it. Government policy can do nothing. Or it doesn't exist. At the end of the day, cigarettes cause lung cancer. We know that. We've known that for years. But it's taken us a long time to wake up to that. How long is it going to take us to realize that, you know, global warming, climate change, whatever you want to call it, it's happening. So we can bicker over the name. We can bicker over, oh, you know, it's not getting any warmer. We see these violent storms. And for me, it comes down to the externality. It comes down to, should we be producing electricity where we can with solar panels and with windmills? Should we be getting away from burning fossil fuels? It's just the way I see things. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com or Stitcher on your smartphone. Quick break, right back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Oh, 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Only 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. April 16th was National Library Workers Day, and AFSCME, which represents 25,000 library workers nationwide, held celebrations, including one on the steps of the downtown library in New Haven, Connecticut. WIN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
AFSCME represents 40 workers in the New Haven system. Librarian Bill Armstrong mentioned some of the things the library can do for patrons.
We can help you find out how to bake a cake, fix your car, and play the guitar. In short, we help you do the things you want and need to do to improve and enrich your lives, and if we can't, we'll find someone for you who can.
The last comment may have been a reference to four Connecticut librarians' courageous refusal to honor the conditions of a national security letter sent out during the Bush administration, which demanded that librarians turn over information on patrons' library use as part of the war on terror and not reveal their actions to anyone on pain of prosecution. They were eventually vindicated and not prosecuted. Others spoke of all the cultural and educational programming that's available at the main location and at the city's four branch libraries. Things like reading hour for babies, English classes for immigrants, computer instruction, and help with job searches. 10-year-old Alejandro Lopez also spoke in praise of librarians. He said his mom has been bringing him to the library for years because his whole family loves to read.
In the Fairhaven Library, she can get her books in Spanish, and I get my fiction and nonfiction books and movies. The staff there is always friendly and helpful.
As budget cuts come and go, library hours have been cut back and workers laid off. Many residents say libraries should be the last thing to be cut, since they serve such a fundamental role in the life of a democracy, and since patrons tend toward those of lower income who have less access to computers. Melissa Canham Klein said she became a librarian because of the wonderful staff she met at her branch library. She began as a volunteer, then a part-time worker.
I started at the very lowest level of the library, and my brothers and sisters of Locals 31, 44, and 884, they took me from that lowest level on up. They believed in me. They taught me the skills I need. I went to library school to learn the rudiments of being a librarian, but I learned the practice of librarianship from these people here. Thank you.
Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Well, you know, right there, man, Mr. The facts be damned. Reality be damned. Put his name on everything. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, the website, that's where you go. Stitcher. Good news for United Health Group. You know, the guy who, if you remember their CEO, Bill McGuire, over a five-year span had taken about $1.7 billion in compensation. $1.7 billion. Because, you know, hey, there's just nobody else who can do that job, right? Well, it turns out they had a great year again this year. They are the largest health insurer in the country. They're the recipients of some government handout. And they're not happy that it's being cut. The gravy train is being slashed. Understand, United Health Group, they're the largest handler of Medicare Advantage. And for those of you who know, Medicare Advantage is the privatized version of Medicare. It's where, in 2006, along with the prescription drug bill, the Part D, that said we can't negotiate for prices, that we cannot do what consumers do in the free market, that the right loves to say that they love the free market. We can't do that. We pay retail. And I guess that's because we're Americans, damn it. We pay retail. They're upset. In fact, they announced last week that despite the fact that they had a 14% decline in their earnings, they still made $2.1 billion in profit. And that was just in the last fiscal quarter. Let me say that again. In the last quarter, they had a profit of $2.1 billion. Where did they get the majority of their money? Oh, yeah, Medicare Advantage, the privatized version of Medicare. Now, let me ask just a simple question. Because we're told that these private plans compete and they're far cheaper, we have seen $2.1 billion in health care dollars that were supposed to go into Medicare put into profit and into people's pockets. That wasn't health care. Now, as part of the Screwquester, there was supposed to be a cut. The Obama administration was going to cut its reimbursements by 2% to the Medicare Advantage. Well, congratulations, the Obama administration has done an about-face, and they've actually raised the rate 3.3%. So what you've seen is a 5.3% increase, thank you very much, in what it should have been. So now United Health Group, they're going to have, I can't wait to see their second quarter returns. And I guess that's lobbying money well spent. For me, again, you look at this privatized plan. This was the poison pill. And this is what the Republicans do so well. They throw out this wonderful idea. Let's introduce competition. Even though we don't believe in competition. We believe in rigging the game so that our people win and screw you poor people and workers. You know, screw you the disabled, screw you the elderly, screw you the people who need it the most. But if we can get a corporation who's going to make a little bit of money on the side, give us campaign contributions, so much better for it. Now, these Advantage plans and the statistics that I saw about a year ago that I think were fairly credible said that 3/4 of the seniors are enrolled in traditional Medicare. And they consume about 1/4 of the costs. 1/4 of the folks enrolled in Medicare are in the Advantage plan, the privatized plan. And they cost almost 3/4 of the total amount of money that goes into this. And you go, wow. Not only do they get to cherry pick the people that they get, because you know you're going to offer plans to people who go, well, I can get it cheaper through this private plan with a couple of extra little pieces of window dressing. Save some money, get a little bit better benefit, because I'm younger, the younger age of Medicare, still healthy, don't have any problems. And then if something goes wrong, well, then I can go back to Medicare and let them pick it up. This is another example of that whole free rider system that the right, who keeps telling us they want competition and they want, you know, honesty and they all, and transparency and all that. No, they don't want that. They want to figure out, hooray for me and screw you. And what's been going on is we've been draining Medicare since 2006 at an alarming rate. And I look at this and I ask the question, you know, what's it going to take for us to wake up and realize this? What's it going to take for us to realize that we're getting the royal screw job in all of this? What we need, and I've been thinking a lot about this. Over the weekend, you know, we saw in Boston, there are a couple hundred people who had to be treated in emergency rooms. And the stories that I saw come out showed of an area that was able to treat some, you know, 200 people for injuries in a very short period of time. And why is that? Well, a lot of it had to do that, you know, you had an infrastructure in place. You had a fairly large hospital system where people could get the critical care that they need. It was there. They didn't have all of the closures that you see in poverty areas where people are at high rates of uninsured. And to me, I go back to the, you know, and give Mitt Romney the credit that he deserves, even though he wasn't willing to stand up during the election in 2012 and demand that he be given the credit. And he deserved it. Look, he signed it. He may not have signed it willingly, but he signed Romney Care into law, which means everybody there had insurance, some form or another. And I know early on there was a story of someone saying, well, you know, the Boston Marathon people, they didn't have insurance. Now they're going to get into the cost structure of high deductibles and all that other stuff, which they're going to need money for. But you have this hospital system that's there because there are no free riders. Everybody has some form of insurance. Everyone has the ability to pay something, which has this large system which is capable of existing to meet needs like this. And I've said for the longest time, you need a hospital in every community. Even if it's not profitable, you need it there as part of the commons. You need it there to do the random screenings, the physicals, all of the emergencies, and you need a well-trained, highly qualified staff in all of them, all across the country. To go, we need to put a profit motive with this just seems ridiculous to me. Because here you have this tragedy. Stop and think about this with me for a second. You have this massive tragedy. Some 200 people injured, 3 dead, at least 10 people who are in need of amputations. You've got all of this blood and this gore and this tragedy. What happens if you're in a place like, I don't know, a place like Detroit? Where, you know, the hospital is closing down. Can't afford to have an emergency room because only the poor people come to the emergency room. What happens if you lose your infrastructure? Because, hey, it wasn't profitable. Couldn't turn a profit, so we couldn't exist. What happens then? And I've been thinking about this for a while that, you know, healthcare is one of those things that should have never been allowed to be made for profit. It should have always been something that we've done as a matter of course. It's a matter of our community. It's something that we do for ourselves. And I do believe there are things that we should do for ourselves. Police departments, fire departments, hospitals. You know, those things that we do collectively shouldn't have a profit motive attached to them. I mean, producing tennis shoes and T-shirts and bicycles, that's all the free market. I don't absolutely need any of that stuff. But if I'm lying on the ground having a heart attack, I need to know to make sure that there's an ambulance coming and that there's someone on the way who's qualified and trained and not someone who's going, well, hold on, let me check, let me do the hospital wars. There's a guy who's got a heart attack and there's a guy with a broken leg. And there's a guy with some weird disease. Who's the most profitable? Or maybe I can pick them both up on the way and make one trip and get 2 fares. Is that where we're heading with all this? And that's scary stuff to me. The whole idea just, well, it is what it is. But we're fortunate that in Boston, the folks there had this infrastructure, and I truly believe the fact that they have these hospitals and this stuff in place is directly related to the fact that they've all got health care and that the infrastructure exists because of that. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together, we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Growing up in small-town Texas, I quickly learned about fighting, including this valuable lesson. You should never hit a man with glasses. You should use something much heavier. This also applies to fighting for our good earth against rapacious profiteers, the spillers and spewers, frackers and extractors, drillers and pipeliners who view our environment, communities, health, and happiness as barriers to commerce that must be shoved aside. The heaviest tool we have for striking back is the indomitable human spirit that, when pushed, produces a fierce feistiness, tenacity, and organized resistance. I can even put a name to this spirit. Nancy Zorn. She's a 79-year-old grandmother from War Acres, Oklahoma, who's refusing to be shoved out of the way of ExxonMobil, TransCanada Corporation, and other giants that are trying to force the massive Keystone XL pipeline down America's throat. That pipeline would carry a nasty, extra-toxic sludge oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to oil export facilities in Port Arthur, Texas. The crude would be piped right through Oklahoma, where TransCanada already is underway with construction. Well, it was underway until Grandmother Zorn literally put her neck on the line. Using a bicycle lock on April 9th, she attached her own neck to one of TransCanada's huge earth-moving machines, halting construction. "I can no longer sit by idly," she declared. "It is time to rise up and defend our home. It is my hope that this one small action today will inspire many to protect this land and our water." This is Jim Hightower saying, of course, TransCanada had Nancy arrested, but it can't stop her and thousands of other spirited souls from continuing to fight this destructive corporate greed. Join them. They're organized as the Great Plains Tar Sands Resistance at gptarsandsresistance.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Maybe this guy from Pittsburgh, this 70-year-old guy, Frank Zeller, maybe he should have run for the hills. Castle Shannon resident. You got to love a story like this. A 70-year-old guy is in Barnes & Nobles. He has a briefcase, and he asks some customers, would you mind watching my briefcase? And then he gets it into his bright mind that he would joke that, well, there's a bomb in it. And I don't know how you make that joke just days after what happened in Boston, but the 70-year-old, who you would think would know better, made the joke to the customers, who then obviously told the Barnes & Noble store employees, who then called the police. Guess what they did? They turned around and alerted the bomb squad. And then what happened? They evacuated the mall, and what he thought was just a little joke of saying, there's a bomb in my briefcase, turned into what I would, my mother would say, would be a federal case. He is now in jail, 70 years old, and he blames the arrest on, and I love this, hoity-toity kids. Because he said, in my day, we'd have laughed it off, you know? He said, there's no hope. What there's no hope of is a 70-year-old guy got to be this old being this stupid. Oh, my goodness gracious. Anyway, let's find out what's going on. On Saturday, there was a big rally in the Chambersburg area, and our crack on the man, on the street man, was there. Jake, tell me about it. What happened?
Well, I survived, Rick. I didn't pick up any suitcases on Saturday, so I survived. It was a serious rally. Well, I'd say about 100 people showed up. Excellent rally. It lasted maybe an hour and a quarter. Right to work traditionally in this state, probably as long as I've known anything about politics. Usually on an annual basis, somebody brings it up, but it tends to die in committee. This year, I don't think that's going to happen. As you know, the nomenclature up there has decidedly right-wing. I mean, this is the same crew that has pushed the privatization issue. That this is the same crew that wants to go after prevailing wage, that wants to make sure that we don't get a raise in the minimum wage. And these people are serious. I think we make a huge mistake if we underestimate him. By the way, there's a plethora, a fairly large number of right-to-work bills coming up. So these people are serious. They're well-financed. Make no mistake about it. This would be the cherry on top of the sundae if they could get it. If you think that it can't happen in Pennsylvania, think of this sobering thought of the, in my mind, Rick, of the two states that have the richest labor history, I would say Pennsylvania, with Michigan a close second. And look what happened in Michigan. Who would have thought that Michigan, with this, its tremendous labor history, would one day be a right-to-work state? Here we are. Yeah. It happened in Michigan, and it can happen here. The mayor spoke. He probably spoke longer than anybody, and I was totally impressed with this man. If I wouldn't have known who he was, I would have thought, wow, this guy's a very good labor leader. Spoke for 15 minutes about what labor unions have done for the country, both for union and non-union workers. He went into great detail about his deep respect for labor. And that's great to see. A lot of times we, as you know, we back candidates and they all too often they kind of shy away when they get in office. And, some of the tough votes when it comes to labor, they shy away and they forget what they say they stand for. But this guy is four squares, in our corner, and that was great to see. Some important people running for office, John Hanger running for governor. He was there. As you know, he's a former member of the Rendell administration. I believe he ran the Environmental Resources Department for Ed Rendell. Every time I go to a labor event lately or an event involving the Democratic Party, he's there. Brad Poplinski is running for lieutenant governor, the Harrisburg City Council member. He was there. Another staunch ally of labor. Daryl Vance, you know, our buddy from the letter carriers, he had the best quote of the day. He talked about right to work. He said, right to work never, not yesterday, not today, not forever. And I love this line, Rick. He said, you're going to have to pry my cold, dead hands from my union card. And that sends a message. And that's exactly the attitude that we have to have. Zach House probably had the best speech of the day. He made a call to arms that we really have to organize. He's exactly right. I mean, we really have to take this threat seriously. There were also about three international representatives that came from Maryland. But it was a great rally, Rick, and at the end of the day, we gotta contact our representatives, contact our senators, and tell them, look, this state does not need right to work. I mean, the people who advocate it keep pulling out this BS that, oh, you know, it's a panacea to our economic problems. Well, when you look at the numbers, as you know, in a right-to-work state, I've seen numbers anywhere from 20 to 25%. The wages are lower. And what's a major indicator to me, whether a state is really economically doing well, it's the job numbers. And when you look at the unemployment figures of the top 10 states, there's actually no difference.
Yeah, well,
there's
it's
no
also
difference between the right-to-work states and the non-right-to-work states.
Beyond
so this idea that it's a it's a panacea for economic times. It's just a big fat lie.
Now, but beyond the just the job numbers, you look at the child poverty rates. You look at all of the other numbers that are in there. The number of people who are getting their health care from state programs. The
yes.
number of children who are on mm-hmm. school lunch programs. The number of families who need food stamps. You know, the wages just aren't there to support a family in a lot of these right-to-work states. And to me, that's a huge part of this.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And you look at the South, solidly right-to-work. And it's just what you said, the poverty numbers, education. And here's the final irony. In a lot of these right-to-work states, they get what? They get a greater percentage of what? Federal assistance.
Right.
Because they need that federal assistance when it comes to poverty, feeding children who are hungry, the whole gamut. No, you're exactly right, Rick. But we don't talk about those issues very much, but we sit back and all too often we allow our enemies to say, you know, this is a panacea, and I got to tell you, there is some support up there. We got to do our homework.
Well, I look
don't
at the Tea Party think tank.
It's going to be defeated.
I look at the Tea Party think tank, who's got a sitting U.S. senator pimping their program around to donors, begging for money. A sitting United States senator begging for money to give to the Tea Party think tank at the Commonwealth Foundation. And I said, you know, there are people who are pushing this garbage, and it's somebody as powerful as someone that is sitting holding our office.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know, it's this whole mentality when the economy's bad, you wanna blame people for it, and it's so easy to say it's those overpriced union people. You know, and if you're uneducated and you really don't know the issues, and there's one other sector I forgot about. There are definitely one they definitely want to go after the unionized state workers. That's another one of their agendas. So it's just more the right wing attack. But they mean business, and we gotta thwart it. We need to call our representatives. I can't say that enough. Call them and tell them.
But
right
even by
work
that, even beyond
the wrong
that,
way to go.
Even beyond that, Jake, is doing what you guys did on Saturday, and that's getting out in the streets. There needs to be more of that. There needs to be more education, more talking about these issues, because you know I don't want to frame it just in, well, you know, we're protecting unions. We're not. We're protecting workers, and most people that I know, if they had the ability to hold a union card, they would. The problem is our labor laws are so screwed up, and you've got so many of these anti-worker politicians who don't mind it that way. You don't see them expanding the rights of workers. You always see things constricting. And you know, I was amazed at listening to your favorite station, listening to those right-wing talking heads all the time go blathering on. Talking about, well, if we could just get those construction workers to work for less money, things would be great. And I'm going, what the hell are you talking about? Why don't you take less money?
I heard them today. They were talking about prevailing wage. And that's so wrong.
It's just idiocy.
The truth is that prevailing wage actually saves the taxpayer money.
It's just,
and you know the reasons. I mean, I don't have to articulate them from you, but the truth is that prevailing wage does save the taxpayer money, because the unionized workforce does it right the first time, and they also get it done on time, which means money for the taxpayer. I mean, this is just, you know, prevailing wage 101.
But even more important than that for me is the fact that you have a local construction craft who spends that money in the local
yep.
community, and you have local
Absolutely.
Activity. The reverberation
yep.
effect across the – and this is something the right-wing talking heads don't even want to talk about, because the facts be damned. They've got their ideology. We've got to destroy workers. We've got to create the desperation class, because that way their puppet masters can control everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's a little bit like what happened initially out there in the, you know, Marcellus Shale. I mean, the companies coming in there, the workers, they weren't from the state.
Yeah.
They were from out of state.
So what are you working on now? I understand tomorrow, big gun rally. Daryl Metcalf going to have his gun crazies in.
Yeah, I understand it. Boy, that should be interesting. I'm not so sure I could. I'm not so sure I'd be too safe in that Capitol with Daryl Metcalf. I mean, that man, I don't know. He's the leader of the right wing. wow, with all the problems we have in this country, you know, we're focusing on that issue. It's frightening. I mean, these people want to change our way of life, and we can't let them.
Still no jobs, Bill.
No, that's right.
No
that's
transportation.
Right. And by the
Bill.
Way, while we're on different subjects, for those of you listening right now, that privatization of the liquor stores is in a critical stage. I understand the governor in the next couple of weeks wants a vote on it. So we need to pressure. It's in the Senate. Call your state senator. Tell him no. We got to give some of these state senators the courage. And what that means is a lot of phone calls so that they can tell their leadership, look, I'm getting a lot of pressure to vote no. It is the wrong thing to do. And one thing, the big issue right now is what effect it will have on the beer distributors. Here's one fact that maybe you can use when you call them. In the state of Texas, Rick, I don't know if you knew this, in the state of Texas, when they privatized, within five years, every beer distributorship in that state went out of business. Every one. And I think that's a warning shot that they need to listen to. This will hurt the beer distributorships. And then, if that happens, we're going to have to add those lost jobs to the 5,000-plus jobs that we're going to lose other than that.
No. That's the free market, Jack. That's the free market.
Contractors.
That's the free market. The free market made those companies go to – they weren't competitive. They weren't lean and mean enough.
Well, and then, again, you talk about lies. I mean, you have Metcalf and that crew out there saying, well, you know – We're not going to lose jobs. We're going to create all these other jobs. I mean, these big box stores, they're not going to hire one individual. They're not going to hire one more clerk to take care of that section which sells alcohol. They're just not going to. That's not how they operate. So this fallacy that you're going to have new jobs added all over the place. Do you think these small mom and pop stores are going to add people because maybe now they can add maybe a little bit of wine to it? That's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
Yep.
There's so many fallacies on this issue. And by the way, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, they put out a public statement about 6 months ago. And that public statement said, if there's any state considering privatizing, we advise against it for obvious reasons. That's one thing we don't even talk about, the adverse health effect to dramatically increased use of alcohol. I understand that the Mad Mothers are back, though, Rick. I understand that they're finally starting to get active in it. That was one organization that made the real difference in this state back in the 90s. I don't know if you lived in the state at that time, but I did. That was a tough fight. The Mad Mothers were probably the deciding factor. They were very good. It was an organization made up. A lot of those mothers lost children to drunk drivers.
Yeah.
And you don't hear that moral imperative this time around. The Republicans would like you to believe that there's going to be no difference, that there's not going to be an adverse effect. Well, that's just not true. That's just not true. I mean, you are going to have an increase in drunk driving. You are going to have an increase in underage drinking. All the dark side of alcohol is going to be increased. I mean, there's so many things about this bill. They've given them no local jurisdiction to control too much of a concentration in one area, which they've done in other states. All the negativity is going to be dramatically increased. And you know, once they get 120 stores, or 1,200 stores, they're not going to stop at that. What's it going to be in 5 years, Rick?
One on every corner.
4,000 in this state?
One on every corner, just like D.C., and you'll have liquor.
That's
and
exactly
everything.
Right.
And then, hey, then it'll be wonderful. It'll be just like South Carolina. Anyway,
oh,
Jake, it's great to hear from you. I can't wait to hear about the gun rally.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
All right.
Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So one of those interesting stories that you just got to love. And, you know, a friend of mine said, you know what Iowa stands for? You know, basically it stands for idiots out walking around. Well, they found one of them walking around, a 53-year-old Elvis impersonator. Yes, a 53-year-old Elvis impersonator. He's been doing it for, what, 40 years now, they say? Because, you know, he looks nothing like Elvis, but he's got the weird sideburns. Evidently, had a little property dispute with his mother. Lives in his mother's house, and would you have had it any other way? A little property dispute. Police came out. 30-hour standoff. He fired a shot at the police. They fired back. 30-hour standoff before he finally gave himself up. Some people say he has some mental problems, and you go, you know what? Have you been playing Elvis for 30 years? Yes. Just a thought. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you. We've got some breaking news.
Hit me with it.
Well, the Transportation Security Administration has said that it is delaying the implementation of a new rule. This is the knives on a plane rule, that would again permit passengers to carry small knives and bats and golf clubs on commercial flights. It's 3 days before the rule was to have taken effect. The TSA says, well, it will consider additional input from a group that includes aviation-related interests and law enforcement experts.
Gee, what gave him the clue that might be a bad idea?
I don't know. It's just a funny thing. It's just like knives on the plane. It's like snakes on a plane. It just doesn't gel somehow.
Yeah, because my first question when I saw this is okay, fine, we're going to put knives on the plane. Does this mean I still have to take my shoes off?
Yes.
That's the biggest beef a lot of people have. They have to take their shoes off on the plane to get on the plane. And now you're going to say, here's a knife?
Yeah, you can have a knife, but you've still got to take your shoes off. It is ridiculous.
And, you know, I look at this, and again, you go back and you go, this whole thing to me is ridiculous. All of this, you know, look, if you're carrying a large bag, yes, we should probably see what's in it. You walk through the metal detector, yes. But the reality is, if someone really wanted to bring it down with chemicals, they're going to figure out. And there have been numerous people who have said, well, we could do it. In fact, the Israeli Secret Service people, I forget the name of their organization, but they, you know, that all that stuff is meaningless. And to me, all it's meant to do is to tell me that someone's watching so I feel better.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of pablum there, yes.
And I've said from the very beginning, right at when all of this started, we should just be flying naked. You should be allowed to take nothing on the plane.
Mm,
When you go to the doctor's office, they got those little pieces of paper that roll out over the little examination table. You just put those right at the head, use it as a headrest, and it just comes right down over the seat. This way, everybody feels comfortable that there no one has anything.
I don't know about that.
Not a fan. It might draw some people, but then again, it might hold others away.
I think it might, and it's going to draw all the wrong people.
But it might be good for the airline industry. You know, I've often said that, you know, if you're lonely and you just need someone to reach out and touch you, just go to the airport for the fun of it. Go in and out of security for the hell of it. It's better than the Elvis impersonator. Come on.
True.
So I guess does this have anything to do with today being the, you know, the big day that the planes are going to, that the towers are going to be closing, and, you know, does this have anything to do with that, or?
No, I think it has to do with the fact that it took them a week after the Boston bombings to go, you know, and to do with the fact that all the airline unions, the pilots, the flight attendants, all the airline unions had said, this is the most ridiculous idea ever. And then they started getting widows of people who died on 9/11 in planes who were flight attendants writing to them saying, this is a dreadful idea.
Well, now you've given the Republicans a reason to be all four knives on the planes because, well, the union said it was a bad idea. It must be great.
Yeah, no, they've been all over this. They've been so against this. And I think, you know, it's like a week after the Boston bombings, it's finally sunk in that, oh, maybe it's a security issue.
But I had a friend of mine say, well, what's the big deal? What's the big deal if I take a small knife? 9/11 could never happen again because we would never, and this is the argument, we would never sit idly by.
Yeah, but even when it happened fast.
But, you know, we would overwhelm them, sheer numbers, that kind of thing.
It wouldn't happen the same way.
Oh, well. I guess the answer is just don't fly.
You know, they're not going to do the same thing.
So let's move to the thing in Boston. I got to be honest, I was amazed at watching the weekend coverage at how these two were able to hold, what, some 4 million people hostage, locked into their homes. You know, the news just blew my mind.
It's unbelievable. Shelter in place. It sounds like there's been a nuclear explosion.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at this and you go, you know, I didn't really hear a lot of people complaining about being locked inside. But, you know, what's amazing to me is, wow, how much control these two idiots had over the area. I mean, it's...
So much. And I don't think they were even aware of it. I don't think they were aware that they were controlling the entire city. They were just trying to get away.
And
Manhattan.
And the part of me goes, you know, the media coverage, the frenzy that went into it is going to get... And look, I don't think this had anything to do with Al-Qaeda or any of that. I think this was just a guy who was just a crackpot. But my problem is then the next crackpot is going, look what this guy got.
Well, that's the concern. It's a real concern, particularly with soft targets. I've been amazed. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a really big mall like Tyson's Corner here in D.C. and said to myself, particularly being somebody coming from Europe, said to myself, this is a soft target. Why hasn't somebody hit this?
And people wonder why I hate crowds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, you know. And we did learn something that the FCC doesn't mind the F-bomb.
Not in the right context.
Oh.
You just gotta get it right.
So what is the right context? Does it have, you know, because he still said it.
He said it, but it was patriotic, I suppose.
So,
not even patriotic, it was townyotic.
Okay, so, well, maybe we could recreate that at some point. And get away with it? Well, maybe not.
I don't think get away with it.
So Miranda rights. What's going on with this? I mean, why in the hell would you say maybe we didn't Mirandize him?
Why would you take that risk?
Even if he's unconscious, you have three or four people reading it to him as you're carting him away.
Well,
they do have exceptions. And if you've got a public safety exception, I see no problem with taking advantage of a public safety exception if you've got a public safety exception.
Right.
Take advantage of it. But then once it's up, hey-ho, time to Mirandize it.
Yeah, here's your aspirin, and oh, by the way.
And I think that's probably, may turn out that that's what happened.
Yeah. So any word on what they're getting out of him at this point? Because, you know, it's widely believed he was the weakest link. Any thought? I mean, I shouldn't even say that.
Nothing.
Shouldn't say the weakest link.
I've heard nothing. But, I mean, you know, I wouldn't know necessarily, but there's been nothing leaked through my Twitter feed.
Okay. Because I shouldn't say weakest link. He did run over the other guy.
Well, did he run him over or did he drag him?
Either
way. Oh, my goodness. 42 million people watched the last hour of the manhunt.
Now, you see, now we know what the next primetime reality series is going to be.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's what my Twitter feed just told me. I was just checking for you to see if there was any information, and that's what it told me. That's incredible.
42. Wow. If we could only get that kind of voter participation.
Isn't that incredible? Gee. I must say, I mean, I was exhausted that night because it was happening late on a Friday, and I've been up since 2. But I crept to my sofa and sort of camped out until I was sure that he was out in the boat, and then I thought, oh, I ought to stay up because I know the president's coming out and I'm a White House correspondent, and then I thought, oh, no, I'll get the transcript.
Yeah, well,
I'm going to bed.
We'll read it in the morning, one way or another.
I'll read it in the morning. I'm going to bed.
That's where I was at. You know, my wife and I had an evening together and just said, you know what, I got to tune this out because I'll be obsessed with it, and in the morning she'll be ticked off at me, and that would be bad.
It was enough now.
So I see we're going to be finally voting on the sales tax online, which I got to be honest, I'm at this point it should have been in place already. The Amazons, the eBays, all of those have been destroying brick and mortar stores for years. I think time's now. Where are we going with this?
They voted. They voted earlier this evening, 74-20.
Wow.
To end debate on proceeding to the bill. So that's the same. It's the same thing, basically. That's huge support, 74-20. Those that opposed it strongly. Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, of course they don't have tax up there. I strongly oppose this measure because it will put a serious burden on small businesses that rely on the Internet to tap into growing markets, expand their operations, and create jobs. On the other hand, though, you know, you've got Mike Enzi from Wyoming who's saying, right now it's not only unfair to small businesses, but it's costing states and localities millions in tax revenue.
Yep. No, I mean, you know, the reality is a lot of people, you know, myself included, you know, you would buy things online and, you save the sales tax. So it's an encouragement to go and do more, especially if you're making big purchases.
Yeah.
So,
but the thing is, we don't know what's going to happen to it, and it hasn't passed yet, but let's assume it passes, which I think it will. What happens to it in the House? Well, it's a little bit less clear what's going to happen to it in the House. Representative Bob Goodlatte, who's in charge of the particular committee it has to go through, is a bit iffy about it. And he has a lot of power.
And?
Well, it may not fly. It may not go through.
I didn't think it would pass the House because that's a tax increase. And Grover Norquist would obviously say no.
Exactly. They're going to call it a tax increase.
Of course. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure that one out. And the Republicans can't be for tax increases, even if it is sane, even if it is rational, and even if it is leveling the playing field. It's still an increase. And finally, the big explosion in Texas. Do we know what it is yet?
No. And I read how it could take up to 6 months.
Yeah.
Extremely complicated to figure this out. I mean, maybe they'll figure it out sooner, but it's extremely complicated to figure out what was the cause of this explosion.
What I love are the Texas zoning laws that puts a school within 1,000 feet and a nursing home and a hospital within 2,500 feet. That's what I like. I like zoning laws that's going to put children and old people and sick people next to an explosion waiting to happen. That's what I like to see.
Yeah, and it worked.
because the explosion happened.
Yep. I mean,
it's quite astonishing. And meantime, the lawmakers who voted against Sandy Aid, Senator Ted Cruz, John Cornyn, and Bill Flores, all want federal aid.
Oh, no. Say it isn't so.
They do. They do. And Flores even voted for the 2011 House Republican budget, which would have reduced OSHA by $99 million. And also voted to pass the Budget Control Act, which has also decreased funding for OSHA's inspections. Why is this important? Because OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is so underfunded, it hadn't inspected this plant since 1985.
Yeah, since I was in high school. I mean, you go back and you think about that, you go, oh my, that's a whole other lifetime ago. Who knows what happened in that place from that time period? And there have been several complaints, I guess, since then, but no OSHA, which just blows my mind, especially when you consider you're within, I think it was like 500 feet there was the school, within 1,000 feet was the nursing home, and the hospital was 2,500 feet. I mean, you're talking right there. I mean, within a decent golf ball shot away.
Yes, right there. It's astonishing.
Yeah, well, again, it comes back down to way to go. We got to get those burdensome regulations out of our way, you know, like putting things that blow up away from, you know, civilization, making sure that there's a buffer zone. That's an onerous regulation, Victoria.
Well, they got rid of that.
Too difficult.
Maybe
when they rebuild it, I've got a perfect place for it. Right next to the governor's mansion. Just wrap it right around the legislature. That would be a good thing to do with it. Anyway,
you know, he might not even argue with you.
Well, you know, geez, fertilizer plant. Wow. Anyway, Victoria, it's always great talking with you.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
On a dark night, where you can see the band of the Milky Way arching overhead, look closely. There are pockets between the stars where the light seems to be missing.
But this seemingly empty space between the stars isn't really empty. It is much emptier than anything here on Earth. But nearly one-sixth of the mass of our home galaxy, the Milky Way, lives in the space between the stars. The stuff between stars is called interstellar medium. It contains ingredients for making new planets, asteroids, and stars.
The space between stars, the interstellar medium, is 99% gas. About three-quarters of that gas is hydrogen, the thermonuclear fuel that powers our sun and all stars for most of their lives.
The other 1% of the space between stars is interstellar dust. This dust in space consists of grains of ice, carbon compounds, and silicate. The interstellar medium is shaped by stellar winds, dying stars, the magnetic fields of galaxies, and vast supernova explosions.
All that matter and activity, and yet most of the stuff between stars, is invisible to our eyes. Modern astronomers explore the interstellar medium using special kinds of telescopes sensitive to radiation in the radio, infrared, and X-ray parts of the spectrum. Come to EarthSky.org and search for the words interstellar medium to learn more. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Democrats in the Senate are terrified that in 2014, the next election,
20 Democrats are up for election, 10 of whom are in very Republican states. If they try and raise taxes, if they shut the government down because they're having a hissy fit that they insist on their little tax increase and that they'd rather shut the government down than not get their tax increase, the Democrats will get wiped out in the Senate in 2014.
Don't blame it on sunshine. Don't blame it on moonlight. Don't blame it on good times.
Grover, the most powerful man in Pennsylvania, who's probably only been here a couple of times, never been elected to an office, but he's the guy who says, no. We cannot possibly consider, no. We can't raise taxes, sorry. Can't invest in roads and bridges and infrastructure, no. Education, absolutely not. Mind-blowing. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, interesting little tidbit. State Representative Bob Freeman, Democrat from Northampton County, he is in the process of proposing a piece of legislation that would mandate that the Commonwealth, every school has the EpiPen. This idea that there are life-threatening allergies out there and that schools need to be more quickly, to have these things more quickly accessible so that kids with these allergies have the ability to have some treatment. They passed a law, I guess it was 2010, that said that students were allowed to carry these EpiPens if they had, allergies, if they had, some, because I had a friend of mine I went to school with who was just, the smell of peanut butter would just send him into anaphylactic shock. Couldn't be anywhere near it. And he had to carry one of these things with him no matter what. Seems reasonable to me. Seems reasonable that you would have something like that in the school. In fact, what's kind of interesting is that we don't already have them. One would think that this would be something that would have already happened. I guess not, though. Seems rational. To me, I often wonder, why it has to be this long drawn-out process. And I guess we've gotten into the habit of so long. Of things being so drawn out and so outrageous that this simple thing of having one of these on site, I'm sure there'll be a lawsuit if there is, it'll be so much better. It'll be just so much better when we've privatized education and we no longer have any. It'll just be wonderful. Yeah, wonderful. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, therickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get it. Again, if you have any thoughts, any questions, any comments, any ideas for our big Netroots Nation cross-country tour, discovering who made America great, and I think the discovery is going to be quite simply, we did. I'm looking forward to it. My kids are looking forward to it. We're building our staff. We're anxious, ready to go. It's rare that I get really jazzed up and really excited. I think this is going to be an excellent opportunity to explore the country, talk to as many people as we can, and, really, really talk about who, what, why, how. How did we build this thing? How did we build this experiment into something that's is pretty remarkable? It's pretty amazing. And what are the good things? What are the bad? How do we move forward? Because, for me, it's about looking backwards, saying, okay, this is how we got to this point. It's about examining where we've kind of gone astray and what we need to do to make sure that my kids have the opportunity that I've had. So I'm really looking forward to it. If you've got any thoughts, any ideas, I'd love to hear from you, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, the podcast is there for your entertainment. Also, Stitcher. See you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous.